today's meeting, the continuation of the public hearing.
Recording in progress.
Copyright amendment bill and the performance protectors amendment bill. The agenda that is followed out during this presentation. But prior to that, I will give over to Karimadja just to present the apology for today's meeting. Over to you, Madja.
Good morning, Chairperson. Chair, in terms of the apologies we have today, we have quite a few. We've got a standing apology from our Chairperson, Mr. Hai. We also have an apology from Mr. Dungle, another standing apology from Mr. Lunchman, and then we also received an apology from Mr. Aplani. In terms of the members in attendance today, we have myself, Honorable Boshoff, Honorable Rautasef, and Honorable Lunt. And in terms of our parliamentary officials, we have myself, our co-committee secretary, Ms. Nizulu, our parliamentary legal advisor, Ms. Advocate Fandamadeva, Advocate Gwenya, and then also our committee assistant, Mr. Bazir.
Thank you, Maria. Let's note those apologies, and then you can then fly the agenda for us. Thank you. Honourable members, the agenda is tabled. You can see that between and the chat was our guest members logging in, and it's going to be a long day, but of course I think it's important that justice is done in terms of the items on the agenda, which is the performance protection and copyright amendment bills. What we'll then do without the interest of time, given the fact that time is on our side, let's then invite the chair of the Intellectual Property Law, Mr. Anton Moster, to take the floor. I see that he's accompanied also by Professor Sadula Kachika, and also Fadonner and Johnson. Without the interest of time, the floor is yours, Mr. Anton Moster, the chair. Over to you. Can we have the team circulate and lighting the presentation? Do we have the chair on the platform, Madja?
Yes, we do. Professor Kajika, he is on the platform chair.
I am here. I think we've just switched from auxiliary power to mains power because of load shedding, so I am back, I think. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you, then the floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Chair, for the opportunity to make oral submissions. I don't know if you want me to share my slides or will you be putting my slides up. I'm happy to share my slides. I haven't changed any substance. I've just swapped the order of two slides, but it's up to you if you want me to share my screen.
We would appreciate that, Prof.
Let's do that.
Your face. And then probably then you can then
okay, I
take it off.
Okay, so let me see as far as my face is concerned, that's me.
Thank you, bro.
So, I'll kick off. And I must confess that I'm questioning my sanity about the chair's continuing efforts concerning the copyright amendment law. Apparently, Albert Einstein said that the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result. Thus, I had to ask myself, why does the chair, that's the Anton Mostert Chair of Intellectual Property Law, continue to make written submissions despite the fact that very little has changed, all the major concerns remain, which leaves one with the justifiable impression that what we have gone through in the form of written submissions and public hearings and public participation has merely been an exercise to create the impression of proper consultation and public engagement. In other words, this has all, over the last, 7 years or something, been little better than a sham of public participation and engagement. And it's not unreasonable to conclude that after so many years, in light of the serious concerns raised about the bill and the outcome, which appears to have been predetermined, and the agenda for this bill, quite frankly, appears to have been captured. So, I don't know if you can see the next slide of mine, which says, where did the bill come from? I'm just trying to get there, but it doesn't matter. Now that we are facing, can you see my slide presentation?
Yes, you can see.
Okay, I'll put it on.
We are with you.
Okay. Slideshow, let me just try and do it a little bit better. I must say I'm a bit technologically challenged at the best of times, but I'll continue because you have my slides. Now that we are facing crippling blackouts, the perilous state of our government institutions, I don't believe is up for debate. As we know, the rot set in state institutions at least 15 years ago. So should we all sit here and pretend that the DTI was some island of excellence over the same period while other government institutions and departments were dysfunctional? I think I'm not the crazy one if people think that. I think people who still believe that the DTI and other state departments were functioning to their full potential and duties, I think are somewhat misguided. And that has shown in this copyright amendment law process. I don't think the DTI has handled the matter in a competent, credible, and transparent manner. If anything, the passage of time, and that's the benefit we've had since 2015, has only vindicated the concerns we raised right at the beginning. It really is difficult to be restrained about the bill, let alone complimentary. It has resulted in a huge amount of wasted resources to fix something that should never have been before a portfolio committee in Parliament, because of its fundamentally flawed nature, both procedurally and substantively. And it is that which motivates me to appear before you. It is the fact that we are dealing with another chapter in my area of expertise and interest in the saga of a failed state. And it is an attempt to draw people's attention to the various ways in which a failed state manifests itself. and it leads to a wholesale perversion or corruption of a constitutional democracy. A constitutional democracy which on paper is to be admired and should have resulted in a much brighter reality for our country, but of course we are instead faced with crippling rolling blackouts. So to some extent, my job today is really an easy one. I should not have to bore you with the minutiae and technicalities of an esoteric part of the law like copyright law. The written submissions the chair has made have enough of that detail. If I have failed to convince you of the deeply concerning nature of the process of this bill, quite frankly, the battle has been lost and then we are reduced to just tinkering around the edges of another consequence of a failed state. That is sadly so because I'm painfully aware that with its majority the ANC can force through and has forced through ill-considered legislation over the past 15 years. All I can hope for, Chair, is that there has been an epiphany on the part of enough people in government like yourself that there is a return to some semblance of accountability, scrutiny and good governance. That's what I'm hoping for. And I must emphasize that this is not even a question of whether I'm right about the technicalities of copyright law. Of course, I do think I'm right, but that is not first and foremost. This is first and foremost about our constitutional democracy, and if we are serious about hanging on to the notion of the rule of law and a constitutional democracy. The public was rightly shocked at the revelations of state capture before the Zondo Commission about the hundreds of millions of rand channeled to the Guptas and companies like Sasa, of course at taxpayers' expense. Well, let me tell you that if my concerns about the DTI in relation to the bill are concerned, or even partially correct, I think those losses will pale into insignificance compared to the losses that this country will suffer going forward. The substantive changes proposed by the bill could do untold harm to the prospects of future generations in this country. In effect, we are relegating them back to becoming the users of goods and the carriers of water. We are condemning the future generations of this country to becoming second-class citizens in a global village. Just to be absolutely clear here, the proponents of the bill like to portray themselves as somehow being the vanguard of change, the champions for education, and the fight against poverty, or some other nice-sounding social. However, amongst them are a fair number of lobbyists who have been willing to exploit the opportunities presented by a dysfunctional state, and they have been strong on rhetoric but thin on the details of law. Even the so-called experts that have apparently informed the DTI's agenda demonstrate a shocking lack of understanding of copyright law, which appears to have determined the agenda. And I'll give you some examples of that, the emotive language used. And for the rest, even if we assume, you know, the rest of the proponents of the bill, even if we assume that they're genuinely pursuing particular interests, I'm afraid the fact that they are prepared to turn a blind eye to the clear failures in accountability and transparency in a constitutional democracy simply helps to drive another nail in the coffin of a constitutional democracy. It is undermining our democracy because it fails to address issues on their merits and allows the government to find scapegoats for its failures. I'll elaborate on that too later. For example, in relation to education, The proposals potentially undermine that which it purports to promote. If that were not enough of a terrible legacy, they should realize that they are doing so at the cost of intellectual impoverishment of future generations. Their approach is like someone who says, I'm not harming the zebra because I'm only targeting a particular stripe. The zebra does not survive if everyone thinks their action is not causing harm by only targeting a particular stripe, regardless of the overall consequences. By doing so, they are not exhibiting the spirit of Mandela, but more that of Machiavelli. If you think my remarks are somewhat dramatic, and of course you are justifiably entitled to be skeptical about what I'm saying, let's start at the very beginning with a very elementary question. Where did the copyright amendment come from? It started under the directorship of MacDonald Netsitenze, who back in 2015 did not provide an answer to the question, let alone a credible account of where the bill came from. To date, the DTI, and I pursued this via the Western Cape government as well, I was at the Parliamentary Portfolio Committee meetings, I think it was 2 weeks ago, requesting information from the DTI. Of course, I'm yet to receive any credible account of where the bill came from. So Mr. Netsitenze refused to tell us where the bill came from in the absence of a parliamentary standing portfolio committee. But I do know the late Mr. Netsitenze did have an event with Google, and that the DPI and the portfolio committee clearly chose to be counseled by a particular group of individuals who were permitted access and opportunities to influence the bill that were not afforded to others. So it will come as no surprise to you, Chair, if you read the bill, that a company like Google would be very happy with the proposal. In fact, they have campaigned in various countries to get what they seem to be getting in South Africa. In the other countries where they have been, of course, more robust and functioning state departments, they have been unsuccessful in their lobbying efforts. But if you have a dysfunctional state, you can capture the agenda, presumably. And so, for example, just in the UK, Google had lobbied for a wide text and data mining exception in their copyright law, and the UK ministry said that they will not be enacting such a wide exception. So where should the legislation have come from? As I've already alluded to, we don't need to speculate about that answer because the Act tells us what is the appropriate process for this type of legislation. And all previous amendments have started in the prescribed manner, namely with a standing committee provided for in Section 40 of the Act. The fact that there has been no functioning standing committee, certainly in 2015 and probably before then, one again has to ask the simple elementary question, where does the bill come from? Was there a comprehensive review of the Act? If so, by whom? Who ordered it? And who determined the agenda for these far-reaching and damaging proposals? In its exercise of its oversight function, of course, the Portfolio Committee, back in 2015, under the chair of Honorable Joe Fudge, should have demanded answers from DTI. Particularly as it was quite clear that there was a lack of expert involvement in the bill. Apart from the questionable substantive provisions in the bill, it was clearly, technically, incompetently drafted. And that should have sent red bells, red lights and bells ringing to the portfolio committee and demand accountability from DTI about how such a shoddy and skewed piece of legislation could even have been put before Parliament. And why the portfolio committee back then didn't do so is baffling, right? In light of the quite extensive comments on the board. And I must emphasize that copyright law is an esoteric part of the law. So even in practice today, you'll find, I think, fewer than or less than a quarter of attorneys and advocates actually knowing about intellectual property law, because it's not a subject that's taught on a compulsory basis at the majority of universities in South Africa. So when I say that it's easy to discern whether something was competently drafted, it is in fact so, because the law, you quickly give the game away if you're not an expert in copyright law. So with the portfolio committee back then, not only was no accountability demanded, the portfolio committee did an extraordinary thing. They assumed responsibility for the drafting of the bill. And of course, by implication, just accepted the agenda of changes that DTI had already determined. A bill that was highly questionable and defective. And since then, there have been various attempts to steamroller this amendment bill and, of course, the performance amendment bill through Parliament. And if this does not give one cause for concern, then we are clearly past the point of no return in what is a constitutional democracy, or the pretense of one. And lobbyists have clearly spotted a bargain of a lifetime, like the Guptas did with their capturing of the state. Because like I say, attempts by Google to influence the agenda in other jurisdictions have been less than successful. In fact, when I requested information again 2 weeks ago about where this bill came from, I was sent two studies, well, three documents, two studies by which involved a professor, Porus, and they both seem to cite, for example, the UK Gower Review of 2006, but what they do, strangely, is not really tell you what the Gower Review found, but what Google submissions in relation to that review was. Now, what's the point of telling us that when the UK government clearly maintained a fair dealing approach and didn't go to the fair use approach that Google had agitated for and campaigned for? So what's the point of telling us that? It's clearly to give prominence to that line of agenda. And then they give a wholly inappropriate example, again, to suggest that the Americans, with their fair use system, allows for greater creativity by, for example, giving an example of the fact that the West Side Story film was really a working of Romeo and Juliet. And the implication is that, of course, in other jurisdictions that don't have fair use, that couldn't have been made. Now, that is just clearly, absolutely wrong. Firstly, the works of Shakespeare are long out of copyright. And secondly, copyright doesn't protect an idea or a particular genre of work. So, like I say, the quality of copyright expertise, which seems to have informed this agenda, is highly questionable. And in my opinion, I think the DTI might even have a case for asking for a refund of their money. So, and like I said, there's a lot of rhetoric by proponents of the bill. So for example, they quit to label the Copyright Act as apartheid-era legislation, simply because it was passed in 1978. And of course, never before this process has it been suggested that the Copyright Act was in any way racially discriminatory. But they're doing it for effect, clearly. If it was racially discriminatory, then the copyright laws of a number of other jurisdictions which follow the British model are racially discriminatory, and no one suggests that, ever. And so therefore, I take a very dim view of people who play the race card or the apartheid card for this type of effect. In essence, they are acting, as far as I'm concerned, in a despicable manner, by making light of actual racially discriminatory measures that existed in the past and caused people real pain and hardship. And to my knowledge, in fact, there's only one provision that had the effect of sort of sanctions busted. But of course, despite the rhetoric, that provision is not being amended, right? And in fact, even that provision has counterparts in other countries that didn't have sanctions for racial discrimination. So, you know, it's not wholly clear that that one provision is so problematic. So much for the apartheid-era quality of our legislation. So, given this type of opportunism, which is more than evidence, we have a responsibility, for example, again, lobbyists want to, for example, use the group with visual disabilities or print disabled, the Marrakesh issue, as some sort of Trojan horse to push through other highly problematic provisions. So no right-thinking person has any issue with exceptions pursuant to the Marrakesh Treaty. Let's get that straight. So if I'm painted as some sort of anti-Marrakesh Treaty person, let's get that off the table. That's certainly not the case. I am happy to support any amendments that give effect to that. But here's the really revealing fact about that, about the hypocrisy of proponents of the bill. We've used the sort of Marrakesh angle to say, no, this bill needs to be passed because it's holding up the rights for people who are print disabled and visually impaired. This matter actually went to the Constitutional Court. And the proponents of the bill, who have been clamoring for, you know, the same amount of time, 6-7 years, that the bill needs to be passed because there's nothing wrong in the bill, actually, the Constitutional Court said that the bill is not fit for purpose even for the blind and visually impaired and print disabled. It was not prepared to simply read in the draft statutory provision because it said, in effect, that it was insufficient to protect the rights of those people in terms of the Marrakesh Treaty. So much for the bill being fit for purpose. And so much for proponents of the bill, like I say, who are clearly using a vulnerable group for an alternative agenda. And so if I can propose one thing to this committee, let's take the provisions concerning the implementation of Marrakesh off the table, because that tends to muddy the water and allows opportunists a field day. And I don't think they should be allowed to use a vulnerable group for ulterior motives. So that's as much as I want to say. I can speak to some of the slides if I can get them to function. But Chair, hopefully I've been clear in what my submissions are and what my concerns are. And hopefully I've made the most important points that I needed to make. But I'm available for questions.
Thank you, Prof, for the comprehensive presentation that you have made in relation to the two amendments bill. I will invite members of the committee to raise practical questions in relation to what you have presented. We will do so by inviting members to use the raise your hand option. I've seen some of the members, we lost them during the prospectus of the group sharing. Honorable Boshoff, the floor is yours.
Chair, good morning and thank you very much. If I may, I'd like to make a suggestion that we handle the questions after all the presentations, if we could, because we are all going into load shedding or are in load shedding. It just makes it easier to be able to do it one time.
Yes, the progressive one, of course, the question is just whether the presenters will be with us all day.
That's exactly my issue. What time do you want me to be back? And I have to avail myself, hopefully I'll be free. So if you can give me an indication of when you want me to be back, I can...
I think let's, because we are finishing at 18:30, it's a long day for us, so it might be a bit of inconvenience.
This is an important matter, so I'll make every effort to make myself available.
Yeah.
I believe these concern very fundamental issues about our country.
Yes.
As you can see, I'm rather passionate about this.
Let's do this to accommodate the point that was raised by Sonia Bosch, Honorable Sonia Boshoff, on the approach, but also make provision for taking into account that it's going to be a long day. You could raise some questions because I just want to get a practicing question from you. Given the fact that this bill was passed 20 years before the new dispensations,
yeah.
The question that I want to pose is in view of technological advancement, the fourth industrial revolution, from your side, don't you think that because of those developments, there might be a need to make some amendment to this copyright law, given the fact that intellectual property regime is not stated, it evolves. Property regime has its own complexity, just its own structural challenges where the dominant system continues to marginalize the vulnerable in the creative sector. In the artistic world, where the producer in most cases, because of their strength in the game, might continue to exploit the vulnerable performers.
Sure. So you raise clearly issues that I have no problem with acknowledging. So yes, do we need to update our law? Absolutely. As technology moves on requiring changes and updates, and even in light of the Constitution for things like parody and pastiche, yes. However, you must do so in a credible, transparent, and open process involving experts. The Act provides for a standing advisory committee why can the DTI not tell me where this committee is that should exist and what its role was in this bill? So the act, like you say, is quite an old one and needs to be amended. I have no qualms with that. I would actually encourage it and say we must do so. As far as the other issues, I always say to my students, and I want you to appreciate this, because like I say, copyright is an esoteric field, and copyright is the cheapest form of property that any South African can own. A poor girl living in a shack in some rural village, all she needs is a pen and paper to write a world-class novel about something. Maybe it's about her life. The minute she creates that, she has property rights under copyright. It's the cheapest form of property you can own. It doesn't require a government bureaucrat to tell you you're the property. It doesn't require a license. And what the Act proposes to do is water down copyright owners' protection. And that is deeply concerning. Of course, you mentioned that the problem of struggling artists. There has been a problem with collecting royalties, etc. But this bill, and of course there was the Farland Commission that looked at that particular issue. This bill is not so much about correcting those failures and problems, quite frankly. It's about other agendas which seem to have trumped the regulation of collecting societies. And if anything, the point that I make about our future generations. So for example, these wide exceptions relating to education. So why should, this bill is not for me. I'm old, I'm bald, I don't have a future anymore. I'm worried about our kids and the future generation. Why should somebody write a textbook under this new bill if it becomes law, when a university is allowed to simply make it freely available? In fact, you don't want to write the best textbook, because this bill will say universities can freely copy it. What you want to write is the second best textbook or the third best textbook, which is crazy when you think about it, right? So what I'm saying is you purport to encourage education, but what you're doing is undermining intellectual activity. Because I'm better off selling chicken tikka than writing a textbook which can freely be copied by everyone. So, and this is the thing, with certain lobbyists, they have made common cause with the government, and with all due respect, the government that has failed its people. When textbooks don't get delivered in Limpopo or elsewhere, it is not because of copyright, Honorable Chair. It is government failure and service delivery failure. No publisher would have a problem giving government a preferential contract. I mean, you know what the amounts are when it comes to government contracts. And if the thing is about education, government can quickly, if it's minded to do so, hire 2-3 people to say, write a matric textbook for us on mathematics or geography or whatever it is. We pay you a fixed fee, and I'm sure people are prepared to do that because writers don't make a lot of money anyway. And then the government owns the copyright in that and can print books to its heart's content and deal with issues. Don't make copyright a scapegoat for government failure. In fact, that's my problem. And I do believe there are educational campaigners whose hearts are in the right place, but they must realize that, like I say, it's like shooting one stripe on the zebra. What you are doing is ripping strips off the zebra, and the zebra is going to die, and the zebra is our constitutional democracy. Right? So don't focus on your narrow interest without thinking of the larger ramifications, where you haven't demanded accountability of how this piece of legislation came about and why. So you raise valid points, but I'm saying to you, let's deal with these issues on their merits. No one knows, quite frankly,
where the bill came from with such an skewed agenda. And like I say, there are other provisions like this sanctions-busting approach, which I've written an article on recently, saying that why hasn't that been amended? Shouldn't that be amended? So there are a number of provisions that are probably calling for amendment, but we need a rigorous, thorough, coherent, transparent, accountable process. That's all I've been asking for. And we've been roadblocked because I think the agenda, in my opinion, was captured.
Thank you, Prof. Yeah, we have made your proposition. It is fully comprehended and appreciated. And let me take this opportunity on behalf of the select committee to express a word of gratitude to you. Like as I said, it's a whole new program, and giving the passion that you have to speak when you have time, you can come in and out.
Sure, and if you drop me an email, or the secretary drops me an email asking me to be available at a particular time, I'll keep my eye out for that and seek to make myself available too. So that's not a problem.
Thank you, Prof.
And thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you. That's welcome. Honourable members, we will now move to our second presentation from the Motion Picture Association, which is represented by two, I think, Mr. Stan and also Johan Baze, Stan McCoy and Johan Baze, if my pronunciation is correct. Over to you, Motion Picture Association.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Can you hear me okay? Yeah?
Yes, we can hear you, Mr. McCoy.
Thank you. Thank you. It's an honor to be with you today, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I'm Stan McCoy with the Motion Picture Association. We're an international trade association representing major international producers of film and television. Our members are Disney, Netflix, Paramount Global, Sony Pictures Entertainment, NBC Universal, and Warner Brothers Discovery. And we are honored to be a part of the process here with you today. There are three broad questions that I'd like to try to address in my relatively short time with you. First, why is the Motion Picture Association here? Why is our perspective worthy of your consideration? Also, second, why do we assign such high importance to this achingly arcane subject of copyright law reform in South Africa? And third, what action might we suggest that this body consider taking? So if I start with the first point, in summary, we're here because South Africa has massive potential as a great place to make high-quality, internationally successful film and television. And frankly, only a tiny fraction of that potential has been realized so far through tremendously exciting projects like Woman King with Viola Davis, like Beast with Idris Elba. And if you think about just those two very recent, very well-known international projects, they included filming in Limpopo, in Northern Cape, in KwaZulu-Natal, and in Cape Town. So you are seeing, not only an incredible flourishing of production of audiovisual content in South Africa, but also geographically diverse spread of that investment in the country. And that's not even to mention many other exciting projects. Mission Impossible 8, Tom Cruise has spoken very highly of his experience shooting in South Africa. The local production Blood and Water, local film, local director, world-class content being distributed globally now by Netflix. Incredible flourishing of production in South Africa. And frankly, the global audiovisual industry is in need of more great places to make film and television. This is potentially South Africa's moment because of the explosive growth in the industry and the fact that companies like the members of the MPA are looking around the world for where they can make not only new internationally relevant content, but also especially content that is locally relevant and diverse, content that will engage audiences like the South African audience. And there's a synergy in that respect between South Africa's potential as a production destination and its attractiveness as a distribution market for international streaming services, because those services need to engage their audiences with locally relevant content. And in that sense, South Africa presents a particularly attractive proposition to the market. So there are needs on the side of the industry that that argue for South Africa as a production destination, but more importantly, there are tremendous potential benefits on the side of the South African people and the South African government. Inward investment in the audiovisual sector has been proven time and again to elevate economies and bring up not only the local production sector, but also surrounding sectors. So the international consultancy Olsberg, confirmed by the South African Cultural Observatory, found that 67% to 68% of that inward investment in making a film or television project in South Africa actually spreads out to a range of surrounding industries like hospitality, construction, transportation and logistics, and so on. Additionally, so there's a broad spread of that investment, and additionally, that investment is very concentrated during a particular period of time. 72% of the investment, according to Olsberg, comes during the shooting phase, which may be only a spread of a few weeks at a time. I think in the big picture, also, a thriving audiovisual sector in South Africa will provide attractive and exciting jobs for South Africa's young people. And those include not only jobs in the typical jobs one might think of, but also jobs as caterers, carpenters, hairdressers, electricians, makeup artists, lighting technicians, sound technicians. All of these people's talents come together to make a film or television project. And, you know, it's not just the talent you see on the screen or the office workers, but this whole range of artisans and tradespeople who contribute to these projects. For example, in Ireland, a much smaller country than South Africa, less than 10% of South Africa's population, a very recent study found that inward investment in film and television created about 12,000 jobs in 1 year, and that there was a positive return on investment for every euro that the Irish government invested in creating incentives for inward investment. They returned more than 1 euro in tax benefit and tax revenue, and they returned also a very positive return on investment in economic net benefit for the Irish economy, including very significantly tourism benefits, because people see Ireland on international television, and they come and they want to. So I want to conclude this first point about why the views of the MPA are potentially worth listening to by clarifying that we at the Motion Picture Association, we don't make any of the decisions about where to spend money. That's something that our members are in competition with one another to do. Our job at the MPA is to try to work with governments around the world to promote the framework conditions and create the possibility to make great film and television. And one thing that I've learned from years of doing that job is that in the film and television industry, we like for all of the drama to be on the screen, and for none of the drama to be in the accounting department or the legal department. So that's the reason why I say to any government that wants to be the home of exciting film and television that in some ways the most important thing you can do is to be boring, to be stable and predictable, and to provide property rights that follow international copyright norms. That point takes me directly to the second topic, just why do we insist that the obscure technicalities of copyright law are so essential to realizing South Africa's awesome potential as a great place to make film and television. And to explain that point, I begin from the premise that our industry, film and television, lives in the world of the imaginary. We make a product that ultimately actually exists only as digital ones and zeros that are almost infinitely reproducible, practically speaking. Our product has no value in the marketplace without the rule of law, and copyright protection and enforcement in particular, to give value to the creations of the sector. Through the device of copyright law, you, the governments, the lawmakers, you give the creators and their business partners, you give them a sort of a basket made of stable exclusive rights. And that basket, its purpose is to hold intangible value. And the job of the people who make film and television is to fill that basket with as much value as possible and use it to bring to market a project, a film, a television series that we hope will be commercially viable. There's room in the marketplace, in the international realm, for a certain diversity in the baskets. They can and they do have different features. But fundamentally, for this industry to exist and thrive, commercialization has to occur. And that means the basket that you provide, the basket that South African copyright law provides, has to be capable of holding value. So that's what we mean when we say in our submissions that strong exclusive rights are fundamental. We mean that the industry needs, the people who work in the industry need from the marketplace a basket that they can use to bring intangible value to the marketplace that will be capable of holding value. That means, you know, rights that that are strongly protected in the law and that are capable of being enforced under the law. There is the potential for exceptions to copyright to function for excessively vague exceptions to function as holes in the basket. Similarly, limitations on the contractual freedom to make optimal contractual arrangements in relation to the commercialization and the production of a film and television project can also function as holes in the basket. as things that allow intangible value to leak out before the film and television project reaches the marketplace. And our written submissions have identified a number of those concerns, several of them overlapping with points that the professor has already made, and I'm sure that other speakers will make over the course of the day. So I won't go on at great length about the details of the various concerns that are identified in our written submission. What I really want to convey fundamentally is the importance of this basic concept of the copyright law presenting to the marketplace a basket that is capable of retaining value for the creators and their business partners and making possible the commercial. Why do I emphasize that? Because it is normal, it is predictable that an international producer deciding where to make a film or television project will look at risks like the risk of loss of value due to vague exceptions and limitations, or the risk of loss of value due to inflexibility of the law in relation to contractual deals related to the project, the contractual freedom element that I was just referring to. Remember, as I said, international film and television producers, they want all the drama to be on the screen and none of the drama to be in the legal department. So from that standpoint, stable and predictable copyright law that is not beset with vague exceptions or undermined by excessive limitations on contractual freedom is of the essence to the commercialization of intellectual property. A situation everyone wants to avoid, I think, is a situation where in the assessment of where to make a film or television project, you have the legal department saying, no, we can't go shoot in that country because the copyright basket there is full of holes. We can't be sure of preserving the value, so we need to take this project somewhere else. I think that's the assessment that we're urging everyone to try to avoid in this process. So that's the relevance of copyright law from the standpoint of international film and television production. And it takes me right to the third point, which is what action might we suggest to the honorable chair members of this committee? I think an essential starting point here is that we would not presume to tell you what you should do. That is a sovereign decision that that South Africa must make, that the legislators and the government of South Africa must make for themselves, and it is very much your job and not ours to assess what's in the best interest of the people of South Africa. The comments that the Motion Picture Association has are simply designed to try to provide you with some information that we hope can help you to do that. We've tried to highlight issues such as excessively vague exceptions and limitations on contractual freedom that could cause international that the basket provided by South African copyright law is too leaky, that it's too weak to support commercialization of film and television that is made in South Africa. I want to say, however, that in our industry, we are deeply optimistic that film and television production, inward investment can and should be consistent with South Africa's economic goals, that it can provide jobs for young people in South Africa, that it can provide a vehicle for inclusive and sustainable growth that has been shown to have positive spillover effects on tourism and many other sectors. And it's in that
positive spirit that I say, I look forward, and I hope all of us who are participating here today can look forward to the day when members of this body can regularly enjoy the experience of going to the cinema or turning on a streaming service and watching a major international production that was made in South Africa, and then essentially staying for the credits. I always stay for the credits and look at that impressive list of names roll by and see the names of the provinces where it was made, your provinces, and see the names of the individual members of the crew, your constituents who worked on that film. And I think the recent experience of films like Beast with Idris Elba and The Woman King with Viola Davis demonstrate how possible that is. They demonstrate that we're on the board of something really fantastic in South Africa. And I hope that the comments that I've shared with you today illustrate why this arcane piece of legal infrastructure, copyright law, is actually so vital to fully realizing South Africa's awesome potential. If you agree with me and you want to get there, if that is your judgment as participants in the South African legislative process, then we would humbly advise that one thing that is fundamental to getting there is a stable, predictable, boring copyright system that is aligned with international norms as set out in the treaties of the World Intellectual Property Organization. That's our key message today. And with that, I'll sort of conclude my prepared remarks, and I stand ready to answer any questions that the chair might like to throw. Thank you for allowing the
Thank you, Mr. McCoy, and for taking us into confidence in terms of the views of the AU. Let me check whether there any group members have noted the questions that they want to raise. From my side, am I correct to read into your presentation that the view that you are raising is that the changes that are that are proposed in the intellectual property regime around film and television production is a bit dramatic. And it could have the effect in terms of the basket of services that is provided by the copyright regime, and that it has a potential to bring the legal uncertainty because of the exceptions raised, but also the limitations on the freedom to contract. That is the sense that I get from you. But of course, I think your point of departure was to share with us the potential that is there in terms of the contribution of the sector to the economy. Particularly given the demand for high quality audiovisuals and entertainment industry, I got the sense that the center of your presentation is that investors would need a predictable framework to encourage them to invest. What about the our system of positional democracy, which bring protection to property? The fact that the private property is protected, the fact that there's no room for arbitrary deprivation of rights. Any deprivation of rights by government has to be has to follow due process of law, and the fact that transparency, accountability, the rule of law is an integral part of the values that are enshrined in our constitution. But more than that, our constitution is the supreme law of the country, which to a larger degree in terms of other sectors of our economy has made the conditions much more predictable and much more attractive for investors, whether it is mining, whether it is financials, whether it is insurance. The framework that we have has proven to be an asset to us in terms of attracting investors. Can the same be infused into the changes proposed in terms of intellectual property regime through these two bills? Thank you, Mr. McCoy. The floor is yours.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I appreciate that you have just summarized my points, I think, more concisely and articulately than I think I did. So I appreciate both the fact that you were listening and internalized all of that, and that you've shared it back with me. You're absolutely right that my fundamental concern expressed on behalf of the MPA is indeed that. The bill as it's presently constituted does include some holes in the basket in the form of vague exceptions and limitations and limitations on contractual freedom. And we've elaborated on what those are in our written submissions, but they include things like the fair use construct that exists in this bill as a very vague exception and limitation. They include the limitations on the protection of technological protection measures, which are absolutely vital for securing the protection of creative content in the digital environment. And in the realm of limitations on contractual freedom, they include things like the 25-year limitation on assignment of rights and like the contractual override provision that's included in this bill. So there are a number of elements in there that raise this concern about potential holes in the basket. In terms of the South African constitutional order, all of the things you mentioned ring true. I have to say that I am not an expert in South African constitutional law, so probably the professor and yourself and many others can speak to that more fully than I can. We come at this at the MPA from the perspective of not of judging what is appropriate, either as a policy for the South African legislator or as compliance with the South African constitution. That is for the courts of South Africa to determine. We come only to advise you about what the international
business stakeholders will assess when deciding where to make film and television. And you have absolutely understood me correctly, Mr. Chair, that we believe that the copyright environment is one of the essential conditions that international investors will look at when deciding where to make film and television projects.
Thank you, Mr. McCoy, for that response. Just to on behalf of the committee, to express a word of gratitude to the effort that you in terms of honoring our invite. Indeed, it is enriching. We are able to appreciate the angle from which you come from, which is quite appreciated. As we continue to engage with the family, at the back of our mind will be your contribution. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Honorable members, like as you said, if you look at the chart, we advise that other members are logging from abroad, so I suspect they won't be able to speak with us for the whole day. So if members have a point to raise, just prepare it and then raise it so that at least we are then able to engage without necessarily having to burden other presenters or having to wait for us till the end of the day. Thank you, Stan and your team. For presenting on behalf of the Motion Procedure Association. We will now move to our next presenter, which will be led by Kusatu. Pat is with us, if he is on the platform. He can then right at the beginning occupy the stage. Pat, the floor is yours.
Okay. Good morning, Chair. Good morning to members. Thank you for giving us space as COSATU just to share our views on this important bill. Just give me 1 second to share it. So I think it was COSATU, Chairman. We do have multiple constituencies which we try to juggle, and I think, you know, there are varying aspects to the bill. But I think we broadly support these two bills, the Copyright Bill and the Performance Protection Bill, and I'll just go straight to it. I think, Chair, we do, and this has been a very, very long journey, I think, as the first presenter this morning indicated, 7 years plus. But I think as COSATU, we do want to welcome the National Assembly's passage of the bills, the two bills, and subsequent now consideration by the National Council of Provinces. As a COSATU, we do support the objectives and the provisions of both bills. We think they're long overdue, given that some of this legislation has been around for quite some time, the copyright one in particular. And of course, there's a vacuum around performance protections. We think they will go a long way towards overhauling a very outdated existing legislative framework that, as we've all seen time and again, has really seen many performers and artists' rights being undermined, and many times they're not even receiving the royalties due to them. I think we've all seen over many years various actors, musicians, etc., dying in absolute poverty, and then we then make a noise about it, say this is terrible. Well, we think these bills we hope will begin to nudge us in the correct direction in terms of addressing their real struggles. We have seen the need for some exceptions to be made in copyright legislation, specifically for educational purposes, which our teachers' trade union staff too has been quite passionate about. And I think every one of us who are parents would have seen how expensive textbooks are, for example, for university students. Some of them are just unbelievably expensive, and that really is a form of exclusion. You can't have textbooks costing 5,000 rand, for example, one textbook. I think we've all seen the issue of persons with disabilities or visual disabilities, hearing disabilities struggling to access materials too. And we think we need to find the right balance between copyright protection and also ensuring inclusive inclusive society where people have access to education. So we want to say, COSATU, we do welcome the extensive deliberations, the work and compromise made in these two bills by government and by parliament. We think, Chair, it would not be correct to say these bills have been rushed through. I think these bills have been extensively discussed. There's been significant amendments, compromises, enhancements made to them. The fact that I think the President referred the bills, the copyright bill, and specific clauses back to Parliament for reworking, I think was an effort by government to say, let's see how we find each other, how we compromise, was at the same time whilst not losing the progressive objectives of the bill. So I don't think it'll be correct to say, well, that there's been no changes. I think there has been six extensive changes. And I think from our side, that's helped make it easier for us because we did have some concerns at the beginning, specifically around musicians' rights. And we think these have been, you know, significantly sought to address. We think these are necessary to avoid legal challenges of constitutionality. We're always sensitive to issues of threats to investment as a trade union federation. We are sensitive to the need for economic development, and we can't afford any job losses. But we're equally sensitive to the need to protect the legitimate rights of performers and artists who really are very often abused, exploited, and really left into absolute poverty by industry players at times. Sometimes the same industry players now who cry about their own rights, but they don't show the same level of compassion for the rights of these workers. So I think, Chair, we want to say as COSATU, we do urge the National Council of Provinces to support these two progressive bills and to see that they're passed into law by the end of this parliament. Whilst we say that, we do think it's important just to emphasize the obvious that we shouldn't cut any corners in this process. We should avoid exposing the bills to unnecessary constitutional court litigation on procedural grounds. And we think this second bite by the NCP will give space, you know, for that inclusive process. On the copyright bill, Chair, as COSATU, we support it. It's a progressive bill. We think it's going to help give greater access to educational materials for persons with visual disabilities, hearing disabilities in particular, Indigenous students, learners in general. We think the lack of access to affordable educational materials is a real obstacle to learning for millions of learners, in particular those who are NESFAS, the students from historically disadvantaged communities and the poor. And it is a huge burden to persons with disabilities. It's also obviously a burden to the fiscus and universities having to try to assist. So I think we want to appreciate many of the provisions in the bill that we believe will help to protect the rights of composers, of performers, of authors, in particular the provisions providing for updated definitions, the scope of copyright protection, the literary and musical works royalties, the visual artistic works royalties, the resale of royalty rights. And I think also to clarify the nature of copyright and audiovisual works and the shared royalties. Similarly, we do welcome the provisions for royalties for sound recordings. And we know it's a delicate balancing act, but the exceptions to copyright protections for purposes of education, of public information, of libraries, of archives, of museums and galleries. We do, you know, welcome the temporary reproduction and adaptation exceptions, and also the exceptions for computer programs. In particular, we're very keen on supporting the access for persons with disabilities, as well as the licensing application procedures, the role of collective societies. And we think, you know, in terms of providing a balance, we do want to appreciate the role of the tribunal that you spelled out. Chair, I think this bill hasn't, as you would know better than me, with many public hearings, has not been an easy bill to draft or to process. I think we've all seen the huge amounts of contestation, the support from some stakeholders, the opposition from other stakeholders. Everybody's equally passionate and they all have, you know, legitimate interests largely. But we do think that DTIC and Parliament, both houses, you know, have sought continuously and found the right balance in the copyright bill in protecting the rights of performers and artists. On the one side, whilst recognizing the need for copyright protection on the other side, and also to ensuring access for persons with disabilities, as well as educational institutions and students. You know, it's, I guess, the national legislation that do not satisfy everybody, but we do believe that what's before us is a sufficient and it's a fair compromise. We believe that we'll pass constitutional muster. We assume it will go to constitutional court, but we are confident that, well, one, the parliamentary public participation processes have really been exhaustive. They have been inclusive. Of course, they're not concluded yet because you still have the NCP leg, the provincial legislatures as well. We think they've resulted in a bill that does address the needs of society in matters that is very complex and is extremely contested, to say the least. Then, Chair, just listen to the Performance Protection Amendment Bill. Again, we think this is a progressive bill that will help to begin to protect the rights of composers, performers, and authors. We want to support the provisions in the bill, including the updated definitions, providing for performance protection in terms of moral and economic rights, the transfer of rights, the protection of rights for sound recording producers, provisions stipulating the payments and prohibited conduct, offences, and also, again, exemptions for educational, research, and legal purposes. And we think this bill, Chair, will provide a long-sought and badly needed protection for performers who have really been subject to some horrific levels of abuse and exploitation, which is still going on. And Chair, you don't need to think this is a far-fetched examples. We had incidences recently in South Africa of, a stunt performer being horrifically injured in the workplace. Yet because of the nature of the industry and the abuse they experience and some legal gaps in the law, you find some of these workers are not covered by the Compensation of Injury or Occupational Diseases Act, so they can't claim when they're injured at work. These workers are not covered by the Unemployment Insurance Fund. So again, when they go through dry patches and they don't have work, they're not able to seek relief. So there are real gaps. We think this is beginning to nudge our legislative umbrella, not just in these laws, but other ones, in the direction saying, let's see how do you accommodate these types of atypical workers. Sure, the Performance Protection Bill hasn't really witnessed the level of contestational constitutional clarity as a copyright bill, but we did understand the need for government and for parliament to synchronize the passage because the two bills are intrinsically linked. In conclusion, Chair, I think we want to say as COSATU, we do support the speedy passage of the copyright bill. We believe it will play a key role in opening the doors to education to the poor, to those with disabilities. We think it's going to lay a positive foundation for the recognition and protection of musicians' rights. This has been a particularly sensitive and critical area. The TUMSA has been quite passionate, correctly so, in identifying. So we think this is going to help protect these musicians' rights to their earnings, which really have often been denied to them, and often you've seen it just be nakedly pickpocketed or robbed. We want to support the speedy passage of the Performance Protection Bill. We think it's going to lay, again, a positive foundation for the recognition and protection of performers who are really continuously abused by employers, especially, I think, in the Western Cape, which is really kind of the center of the filming industry. Chair, I think lastly is that we believe both bills will play a key role in providing access to materials for the public whilst protecting the rights of performers and artists, and equally simultaneously respecting South Africa's international intellectual property and trade obligations, which are not light matters. We do believe that both bills will pass constitutional muster. So I think that's our presentation in a nutshell, Chair. I think just to the point to say we support these bills. This has been a long journey, but I think we are pleased with the progress we have made in that regard. So let me stop there, Chair, and hopefully I've contributed and donated some time to other presenters who might come on longer submissions. Thanks so much, Chairperson.
Thank you. Making a presentation on behalf of COSATU, very categorical in terms of the support that COSATU is giving to the bill. I will now invite members for clarification questions in relation to the presentation made by COSATU. Oh, and one get a sense that you were categorically clear in terms of the stance and proposition that's put forward on behalf of construction. Maybe that's from my side. Your observation in relation to the openness of the supply chain in the film and television industry, is it broad enough, is it inclusive enough to protect all the actors along the supply chain, particularly in relation to the fact that in most cases we'll have a broadcaster commissioning a producer to produce a film. It's the observation that the current regime that we have is strong enough to protect the vulnerable actors and performers along the chain, or the introduction of the two bills will act as an inhibitor discouraging to the investors to commission or produce film and television series. Over to you, Pat.
Yeah, thanks, Chair. So I think we really highlighted quite a critical issue, and we've spent a lot of time as Passage discussing over the past while. And we had a lot of discussion with unions who organize musicians, TUMSA, which is under the umbrella of COSATU. We've had a lot of discussions with SAGA as well, the South African Actors Guild Association. I think they are presenting later today, if I'm right. And I think the simple question answer is that the rights of these workers are horrifically abused. So yes, on the one side, on black and white, in nice English words, we have a very progressive labor legal framework in the country. So if you lose your job, you're entitled to unemployment insurance benefits. If you're injured at work, you're entitled to compensation injury on duty or occupational diseases compensation. You've got the right to work in a safe environment, workplace. Under the BCA, you've got limits in terms of how many hours you can work a week, how many overtime hours you can work in a week, what is the overtime regime, etc. The UF and the BCA also speak to the issues of paid maternity leave, paid parental leave, etc. But all of those laws, they don't apply for these actors or performers. Partly it's because the nature of workers has evolved. So, these laws often were designed with the intention of a factory worker or a teacher or a nurse, formal work, 9 to 5, Monday to Friday. You can start at the age of 20, retire at 65 or whatever. But there's a huge sector of the economy, which is a rapidly evolving part of the economy, like actors and musicians, Uber drivers, many other types of atypical workers, and they've fallen through the cracks. So we saw Shepherdson during COVID 2020, when we released 64 billion rand from the Unemployment Insurance Fund to help 5.7 million workers in the private sector. But these performers, actors, musicians, weren't able to receive that because they had not been contributing to the UF in COIDA. Partly it's the fault of the labor laws that they are not flexible. They don't have a kind of a hybrid approach. It says, here's what we do for formal workers, here's what we do for informal workers, here's what we do for atypical workers. That's the one issue. But also, Chair, you do have many employers who just simply production houses, both local and international, who come to South Africa, and they just have no sense of regard for workers. You have workers who are really abused, some of these actors, some of them are household names. You recall this, this famous actress who died at 30, what was it, 2 years ago? She had no medical aid because often these actors, they work a 3-month gig, a 6-month gig. They don't have enough money to get medical aid or to get pension, etc. They're not covered by COIDA. Often it's a work of no work, no rule applies. And often these production houses tell the actors, you will be at work for these 3 months. If you don't do that, well, then tough luck. And some of these actors literally forgo getting treatment like this individual actor did forgo getting chemotherapy, died of cancer, simply because of the desperation that I don't know when will I get the next job and so forth. So we need to change this thing. I don't think it'll be an overnight magical thing. This bill won't call everything, Chair. But I think it is going to begin to lay the foundation and say, okay, we're recognizing performance rights. Here's an umbrella foundation law. We'll have to amend other legislation too. We'll have to amend the UIF Act, the BCA, Occupational Health and Safety and so forth, COIDA, to capture the changing nature of work. Chair, I think the other point is that we don't, no, I don't think we should worry about it's alienating international investors. International investors will come to South Africa because, one, we have the quality actors, performers. We have the natural landscape, the scenery, the oceans, the Table Mountains, etc. We have the infrastructure and so forth. A very competitive industry. If we think we're going to attract investment by treating people like slaves, then I think we're approaching growing the economy in an incorrect way. Because that is the way to do it, then we're humanity's in trouble, Chair. I think the way to grow the industry is by respecting people, respecting the actors. They need to be protected, they're injured at work. They need to have some sort of unemployment insurance. If they're sick, they shouldn't be abused, etc. Chair, I think there is possibly that principles. If you look at the United States, and I think Sweden, if I'm right, where they actually have evolved the actors industry to collective bargaining. So if you look at all the movies coming from Hollywood, you'll always see on the U.S. American Actors Guild, I forget the right acronym, association there. That's the American Actors Trade Union. In fact, Ronald Reagan, the U.S. former U.S. president, was the president of that Actors Trade Union. So they take this very seriously. You will not find a movie being produced there without the trade union endorsing that, yes, it confirmed to the minimum labor standards, etc. So I think we need to have that kind of discussion, see how do we replicate that in South Africa. But we shouldn't be saying that, well, the only way to grow the economy is to treat people like slaves in the 21st century, because you're not going to do that. In fact, you're going to spark talented actors moving overseas where the rights will be better respected, etc. So I think first, these are positive feet in the door, and not everything will be fixed now, but it's a positive step forward, and that's why we're supporting each other. And thanks.
Thank you, Max. I see there's also a comment on the and question on the chat. Will this bill, according to you, give back to practitioners and actors and musicians sustainable livelihoods from their sweat and tears? That is the question from Honorable Brenda Matevula. What do you ask?
We think it does begin to push us in the right direction. The copyright bill speaks to the rights of musicians and to other performers in those industries, the protection of the rights to earn royalties, etc., that we're respecting and preserving those rights, because often we see many musicians, famous South African musicians, really dying absolute poverty, yet everybody's listening to the songs. But you would find that their royalties didn't go to them, they went to the production houses, etc. So we think the copyright bill is going to begin to nudge us in that right direction. Of course, it's one thing to have a law which is very progressive on paper, nice English. The challenge will always be about enforcement, but nonetheless, we must try. It will take time. It won't be a miracle overnight. There will be those who will choose to ignore it. We'll have to see how to, as government, as actors, as the trade unions, as the industry, how to make sure there's compliance, change the culture in the right direction. I think the performance protection one is also critical, because it's going to, for the first time, recognize the rights of these performers, so they have rights, begin to put some foundations for it. It's not the end of the road, it's just the beginning of the foundation, but it's a positive place to start from. We are having some discussions at NEDLAC on overhauling our labor laws, some of which are a little bit outdated, as you saw in COVID-19. Like COIDA, UIF, occupational health and safety, etc. Some of it will have to go to regulations, like defining who is a worker. So can we now define actors and performers, musicians, other cultural workers as workers as well? And how do we provide for the self-employed, the atypical workers? So we will need some creative thought. We will need maybe two or three approaches, because not everybody's the same. But nonetheless, I think, the honourable member, we think these bills are a positive step in the right direction for both performers and for musicians. Thanks, Chair.
Thanks for responding to those questions. And again, on behalf of the Select Committee, let me take this opportunity to extend a word of gratitude to the effort that COSATU took in terms of responding to our invite, and the manner in which we're able to put the views of COSATU across to this committee. That is highly appreciated, Pax, and again, a word of gratitude to you. We are continuing with our program. Any last words?
Any last word, Fox? Let's then move forward, if I'm audible, and invite the next presenter, who will be on behalf of the Publishers Association of South Africa. If you can just introduce yourself, Mr. Wafa. Over to you.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. And thank you to your colleagues for allowing us this opportunity on a very, very difficult topic. It's very difficult to even imagine that we are talking about the same thing when you listen to different people. And I think there lies our conundrum. I am today with my colleague, Louise Grantham, who will give us a treatise on the SMMEs among ourselves, and Carlos Kolola Visari, who is our legal counsel, in case I stumble on legal issues here and there. It is a difficult topic that even some of us that have been in this industry and even taught on the topic for 30 years still struggle. So I really appreciate the issues that we are dealing with. There are many things that you have heard about the industry and about the issues that are happening, but there are also many that you have not heard about the same industry and the issues. So I would like to talk a bit about the industry and practices, because yes, indeed, there are problems like the ones cited by my COSATU colleague, but I would give the analogy of a bird that is in a hut, and the bird is infested with bugs, is what happens now in the game. You do not burn the whole house because there is a bed with bed bugs. At worst, you take out the bed and sanitize it outside, or if need be, you burn the mattress, but you don't burn the house. There are a lot of good things that are happening in this industry, and a few pockets of malpractice here and there, and those must be targeted and then dealt with. The first slide really is just about myself. I don't talk about myself because I am important, but because my journey somehow demonstrates what happens in this industry. And who does this industry really belong to? Because a lot of the information, once you convince people that they will be harmed to the industry, the next person that comes is whom does it harm? And usually the flippant dismissal is that it harms international companies and it's not inclusive. This industry is to a great extent a local industry, and the people that will suffer from any negative changes are local people. I have been a consultant to the World Intellectual Property Organization on how to turn IP in Africa into a commodity for social upliftment for many, many years. And I've also met your honor, some of the international people that have spoken in positive light about the bill. And I've met them in debates at WIPO in Geneva. And I'm really surprised why, when they come here, they don't indicate the type of opposition to their proposals that they have encountered, both in Geneva and in their countries. They also don't indicate why they have not made inroads, and that South Africa is the target for them to demonstrate that they have made those inroads. On that point as well, I would like to point out that one of the disturbing issues is that some of the companies, tech companies that have been cited already, approached us very early in the 2000s as local companies and requested that we put our information on their sites for educational purposes like they are proposing now. We thought that paying us 1 cent per use on their sites was not going to make it, and that nobody, after reading our material on their sites, would be willing to go and buy. We said no. And then they went away, and now it looks like they are coming through the legislative process by supporting this bill to get what we denied them, and it would be very unfortunate that in the end, if we die, we are cut by a knife, that is sharpened by our lawmakers, because we have fought them off and we're fighting them off at the international level, but they do not talk about that. Let's go to the next slide. The Publishers Association is not a conglomeration of international companies like has been said, because among ourselves we have 124 members, and only six of them are medium to large international companies, 31 are medium local companies, large to medium local companies, and 87 are local SMMEs. It is not true that most of the textbooks used in the country are produced by those companies and are international textbooks. 100% of education and TVET books are published locally by local authors, 100% content vetted by the Department of Education, and 100% local authors. More than 80% of the expenses in the value chain is spent here. Only a portion of the 10 to 15% net profit is repatriated to international shareholders on behalf of those six companies. Otherwise, the rest of that profit is actually plowed back into future textbooks. All of the international companies have at least a 25% local shareholding. And with the acquisition last year of the largest publishing company by a local investor, we now have 70% shareholding in the sector by local investors. And there's a 50-50 market share in the local international companies in the trade sector. But the reason why it looks like there are many trade books is that when you look at big books like those by Rowling, reporter Stephen King and Wilbur Smith, those ones are blockbusters and they distort the picture. But the majority of publications even in trade are local. And 60% of the education market, 60% of the sector is education. I'm highlighting this because there is a view that says that if you use fair use for education, there will be still something for publishers to rely on. There is very little outside that, because even the 40% that we classify as trade is supported and subsidized by education. We are members of those organizations. The slide about Passamarian. We are members of all those organizations that are listed, the CCSA, the IPA, IFRO, DAURO, and ANFASO. We have supported the need for copyright reform, especially given how old the current Act is and how it has been passed by digital technology. And we also support the submissions by those organizations that I've listed. What is the current state of play in publishing in South Africa? I'm highlighting this because I would like to ask a question at the end. If you are faced with this situation, the exceptions, including fair use, that we are proposing here, are they the solution to the kind of problem that we are dealing with? Current state of play is the next slide. Fiona, there is rampant, honorable members, there is rampant illegal copying, illegal sharing on social media, piracy of textbooks. I would even challenge you to say, as we go through this, just Google any textbooks in the academic sector. You will come across at least four platforms where that textbook is available, either for free or being sold by pirates. 30%. Only 30% sale through happens in higher education. About 70% is fulfilled through illegal copying. And we are not far from where Nigeria was in the 90s, and we are rapidly heading there. The question is, will this bill arrest that or accelerate it? My unequivocal answer is that it will accelerate it. Today, many people argue on what impact this will have on the sector. I think the impact is going to be terrible because we are already feeling it. Some of the academic authors today are refusing to contribute to new editions due to this rampant copying. And you can't blame them because they are not getting much out of the current editions. And they say, what is the need to work on a new edition when the old edition is gone and is being pirated like that? There is also rampant copying in academic institutions that is driven by the NSFAS decision to hand over all funds, including for books to students. Yet, you have also heard how expensive textbooks are, but you have not heard how easy it is to facilitate access at the current moment. Because if you go through Dowro and you are licensing per student on a blanket license annually, the cost per student is 150 rand, and they have all they need for the year with regards to that critical material. But you are always told that books are incredibly expensive. But there are options under the current fair dealing provision. I would like to ask the question, why is this situation not the case in schools and TVET? It's simply because the issue that we are dealing with is a funding issue. And with schools and TVET, there is a proper management of the budget for books, and it's ring-fenced, and students get their books, and you have 100% coverage. And let's not confuse a funding issue and a mismanagement issue or a copyright issue. Because again, we will be making South African authors, who are all the authors that really contribute to this, to be the ones that carry the burden for provisioning of textbooks instead of the state. When we come to the bill, I can really surmise about the bill. That's the next slide there. The bills deliver to the performers what authors have always been enjoying through the exploitation of their work for decades, but potentially takes away everything from education from authors through the fair use provision, and bars authors from participating in future writing through the 25-year assignment limit. When I met my colleague Dev Narain in Nairobi at the Copyright Symposium, I congratulated him and pointed out that indeed there are positive things about the performance bill that will alleviate the situation of performers, because it will begin to give them accruals on their intellectual property going forward into perpetuity, the same way that authors have been enjoying. But what is really tough about what's happening to the authors is that through the fair use, you are giving them something that doesn't exist anyway. Because if those books are going to be copied under the provision of education, what is left for them? Then the next slide is really to go through our concerns. I don't think I'll spend too much time on the concerns. I want to rush to the impact, because the concerns, I think, have been covered sufficiently in our submission and also by Professor Kajika earlier on. But just to indicate that although the National Assembly conceded to some of the issues that the President was concerned about, we can safely say from a study that we have shared with you in our submission that the majority of the concerns were not touched at all, particularly around fair use and the TPMs. And if you buy any software that authenticates information, you can check the differences between the earlier bill and the one that is now before the NCOP, and there is hardly any change on those issues. Let's go to the next slide. There is the overbroad exceptions. The first one is really that 60% of the market is education. So with these exceptions to education, then it would actually be out. If you compare with developed countries where only 40% in education, they cannot even afford the type of exceptions that we are considering here. Think about a situation in South Africa where 60% is education, and say what remains beyond that. It denies education publishers and authors remuneration for their work for the sake of students and funding students, whereas this should be treated as a funding issue. It places a disproportionate burden on publishers and authors to fund the provisioning of education material. The next slide is about a very important topic, which is this whole issue of doing a socioeconomic impact assessment. We did one among ourselves, which was dismissed because it was done by a private sector. But what it revealed is that there will be a 33% decrease in sales, 30% decline in employment, significant business closures, increase in imports, and a decline in exports. And this has not been considered by government decision makers. If there was a proper sales done by government, this would not be necessary. The fair use one has been dealt with extensively, and I do not want to spend too much time on that one, except to say I don't think that there has been considerations of the deviations of the South African one and what that impact will be. We have checked with many colleagues at the International Publishers Association and elsewhere, and they indeed say there is no way where the fair use provision is like the South African one. The fourth one is limiting the copyright assignment to 25 years. I think this will affect publishers a lot. I would like to share with you two stories. The first one is I started my career at Juta in 1996. When I joined them, some of the publications, the top publications, were already 10 years old. I went away for 20 years and came back, which means there is a gap of about 30 years with the first ones. 80% of the publications that was driving main revenue were still those titles, way beyond the 25-year limit. If you look at New Africa Books, a company that I started with, Zwelakhe Sisulu, in 2000, their breadbasket titles are Buckingham Palace by Richard Reeve and Sindhu Magona's Mother to Mother. And those publications are all more than 30 years old, and those are their revenue. You look at Chinua Achebe's Things Fall Apart, 1958. And it's still going. So the 25 years is just a drop in the ocean with regard to the amount of time that it takes for a book to perform. So really to say there is a 25-year limit is like to instruct companies to close down. And the impact will actually be on local companies in a big way. Because for education, for example, what international and big companies will do is to avoid authors when it comes to developing learning tools and rely on digital assets, machine learning and artificial intelligence, and they do without authors. It requires a lot of money, outlay capital to be able to do that. They'll be able to do that and we won't be able to do that. And that will be our demise. Concept five. Regulating publishing contracts, I think that has been talked about by the colleague from the International Cinema Production Company who came earlier than COSATU, and I don't need to go through that in a big way, except to say it will be hard for less lucrative publications and beginning authors to be published, because beyond that regulation that you are looking at, there are many negotiations that have to happen to make those titles publishable. And they will just be ignored. I would like to move on to concern number eight, the socioeconomic assessment study. I started by indicating that it doesn't sound like we are talking about the same thing if you listen to my COSATU colleague and anybody else. But would indeed have helped if there had been a socioeconomic impact assessment, because you would then be looking at our impact from a dispassionate point of view and saying this is what the CS says. But the fact that we don't have means it will be me and it will be them and we'll never meet. So we really think that it is necessary to do that. The one about technical protection measures has been covered, and I would like to rush to who will be affected, which is probably the second last slide. The majority of the players that will be affected are local authors, local illustrators, printers, translators, booksellers, the whole chain. And I've indicated to you 100% of those authors, for example, in education are local. And then local production will be significantly reduced. Learners will once again have to rely on foreign content, as was the case in the 70s and the 80s. We made a lot of progress to localize the industry, but we are now going back. There will be more, very limited investment locally in the fourth industrial revolution and more efficacious new education technology learning tools. And South African IP will be traded internationally at a very discounted value, because if it's 25 years and there are all these issues, who would like to buy our IP? I would like to call on my colleague Louise to say something about SMEs before I suggest a way forward.
Thank you, Brian. Louise Grantham is my name, and I am an
my apologies. Just to sensitize the team that you only have 30 minutes for the whole presentation. So the exchange must take that into consideration. Thank you. You can continue, Louise.
Thank you. I will try to be as concise as possible. I'm an SMME publisher, and I work within the Publishers Association to represent the voices of small publishers. And so we really wanted to make sure that people can see how small publishers will be affected by this bill, by the Copyright Amendment Bill. We've also worked very hard with government on the Cabinet-approved Master Plan for Growth in the Creative Industries to map a way that the publishing sector can grow. And SMME growth is absolutely critical to that plan. So SMEs, as Brian has mentioned, form a large part of the publishing industry. Most publishers, in fact, are SMME companies. And the majority, but have extreme funding issues. Most SMME publishers are privately funded, often by personal or family funds. And there are huge obstacles generally to them making sustainable businesses out of their small intellectual property companies. The 25-year assignment clause and the fair use clause are just going to make it so much harder. But I thought the best would be to just give you an example. So Sindiwe Magona's book, Mother to Mother, that Brian mentioned, was published by David Philip Publishers in 1998. The company was later bought by First Nail and then the Sulu family and became New Africa Books. But Mother to Mother was not an instant success. It in fact only started to sell significantly in 2015, so 17 years after it was published. And then international rights were sold to various countries, and it became a prescribed textbook in South Africa. And that book provides Ms. Magona with her pension today. The royalties from that book mean that she can be financially independent. But that book was published 25 years ago. So as she enters her 80th year, in terms of the new bill, the copyright period would now be at an end.
My apologies, Louise?
Yes.
We have some slides that we're sharing with us.
No, I don't need any slides, so that's absolutely fine. I don't need to use the slides at all. Thank you.
Oh, no problem.
Of the story instead.
Yes, okay.
So because the book was published 25 years ago, in terms of the new bill, that copyright term would now be at an end. And in addition, the book might be reproduced by schools in terms of the educational exceptions in the bill, and then no royalties would accrue to her. And so her retirement funds under the current bill might look quite different. And this is not a unique story. This will be replicated over and over again. And authors like Ms. Magona could have their livelihoods undermined. And SMME companies like New Africa Books will lose revenue from their successful projects that they should use to invest in new voices to become the new Sindiwe Magona. So against this background, the implications of the master plan for the growth in the creative industry seems doomed to fail in its bid to grow SMME publishers. And I really would appreciate if this could be taken under serious consideration when looking at the issues with the Copyright Amendment Bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And given the constraint in time, Chair, I won't go through all our recommended way forwards because some of them are covered by other presenters, but I would just like to highlight a few. Ideally, we would want this process to be restarted because we think the flaws are quite fundamental. but I don't think that would be possible. If it is not possible, we really think that getting to some form of an impact assessment is critical, because as you can hear, we are not speaking the same language. It's different stories, and only that can help us through that. I think we need to acquire legal opinion from expert copyright and constitutional law people to go through this. I also think that we need to request further input from House of Traditional Leaders on hybrid fair use. One of the things that pains me as somebody that consults to WIPO is to see how much our IP is taken by companies that operate in more viable markets, including the story of Mbube, The Lion Sleeps, The Lion King, and even Woodian, and Robust Tea and other things. If we cannot exploit our IP through the growth of the local sector, which is the WIPO position, it will be exploited by others. And I think this is the hidden message that comes from international people that say, just undermine your copyright and you have all the access that you need. But access to what? I really think that part of what is about to be handed over to high-tech companies is also traditional knowledge, and that consultation is needed. The last one is to create some semblance between different departments. My colleague spoke to about the master plan to grow the industry. I serve on the ministerial task team that is looking at the national book policy. And everything that is coming through those documents is at dissonance with this bill. It feels like we have some people that are trying to fill our bucket with water, and there are others below the bucket that are puncturing holes in that bucket. And I think it will be necessary to look at those documents that are initiated by government in the industry and say, how does the bill enable this or undermine that? I would like to thank you very much for this opportunity.
Thank you, Mr. Rafa and Luis, for making a presentation on behalf of the PASA as a structure. Indeed, you have correctly articulated issues that PASA has mandated you to do. I will try to get a sense from the team as to whether is there any interesting questions that you want to pose? Maybe from us, you draw a parallel between, there's a slide where you are talking about, where you draw a parallel between TVET and universities in terms of the benefits that publishers are accruing from TVET, and the approach adopted at university level in terms of student books. I can just elaborate on that aspect further.
So a lot of what we sympathize with is the whole issue around access to textbooks for students.
The exceptions. Your issue is the exception.
On the exceptions. And the question that I was asking is, why is it that in schools we have universal coverage of textbooks? All learners have textbooks. We had problems in the past. And if you go to the colleges, which are at the TVET level, we also have 100% coverage of textbooks. The economies of scale are huge. We publish in huge numbers because every student gets the book. And then the government acquires publications, those books, for every student. We work very closely with those two sectors in terms of textbook provisioning. And even when there was a crisis in Limpopo, we were asked to step in, and I think we agreed to abandon the contract provision that were there and say, this is a special case, let's put in one, two textbooks for great competition. And the learners had everything that they needed. Now, the person that I ask is that, why is that different when you come to universities? The only difference is that there is an allocation that is enough to cater for every student's book needs. But at some stage along the way, it is first decided that in order to learn to teach to these students how to be responsible with their budgets, we are giving them everything, including the money meant for textbooks. That money, some of you would have seen the advert in our Pretoria that said ENS was saying, any come and spend our money with us. And that's where they put the money that is meant for textbooks. And what do they do thereafter? They take a textbook, they scan it, and they share it among themselves. As a result of that, the academic textbook market when ENS did this collapsed by 70%. We're fulfilling less than 30% of that market. So what is the issue here? The issue is not the price of textbooks, because if you make arrangements with Dow for blanket licensing, you can provide for all your students with the critical materials for 150 rand. Yet there is more than 5,200 that is allocated for textbooks that is going to books, hairdos, and technical gadgets. So I was just drawing that parallel to illustrate that what we are dealing with here is the issue of funding and management of those funds, and not an issue of price of textbooks or copyright.
Now, the reproduction to accommodate the one of the exceptions is the reproduction to accommodate the blind. What is your view on that?
The view on that, Your Honor, is that I have been chair of this industry for a long time, and we have never failed to provide the requested material as an industry to learners with any disability. And we have worked with the department, and we have insisted that those learners should get their material at the same time as others. There was a difficulty initially when we moved from Braille to digital, in the sense that the open files that they needed were the same files that you and I would need as people that are sighted. And we were saying we need some form of trusted intermediaries that can actually help us understand that when we release those open files, they are for the use by learners with visual impairment only. And we also believe that the Marrakesh Treaty, I was involved at WIPO on the negotiations of the Marrakesh Treaty right up to the time when we signed it in Marrakesh, Morocco. And what that does is to really provide legal mechanisms that would allow people that represent people with visual impairment to have access to those materials without being constrained by copyright. So that has been isolated and can be dealt with by acceding to Marrakesh. And the question is, we have been urging government to accede to that and sort out as quickly as possible. Even the court case that Blind SA had to take to government would not have been necessary if Marrakesh had not been acceded to. So I think it's disingenuous to not do Marrakesh on one side and then bring the issue of learners with visual impairment to the broad discussion on copyright when you are not utilizing the tool that is available.
Well, thank you, Ms. Loya and Ms. Lewis, for the time you took to respond to our invite, indeed, on behalf of the Black Committee. Our sincere gratitude to you as we continue to listen and deliberate. Will take into account the views that PAF has articulated very strongly. Thank you.
Thank you.
Members, we are moving forward. The next presentation, let me just open my agenda. After PASA, we will then invite the Licensing Accessibility Society of South Africa, which is represented by Mr. Danny Domain and Mr. Johan Dupree. Over to you, the Licensing Accessibility Society of South Africa.
Good afternoon, Honorable Chairperson and members of the committee. It is an honor to be before you today and to have this opportunity to present With me is Mr. Johan de Kreer. He is the current president of the Licensing Executive Society of South Africa. I'm the immediate past president. And we've got a presentation which I just want to share, and then we can go forward.
The floor is yours.
Thank you. Just some background on the Licensing Executive Society. We are the South African chapter is part of a larger international organization, the Licensing Executive Society International, LSI. And LSI has been formed 50 years ago and is one of the foremost global organizations in the field of technology and licensing. We've got 33 national and regional societies throughout the world, a diverse membership, more than 6,500 individuals from more than 90 different countries. But importantly, our membership is extremely diverse. It's from a range of industries specific that works in all kinds of IT fields, as well as from academia, and also from the legal profession. Just a disclaimer on our presentation, we are not representing LSI in this presentation. We are representing Licensing Executive Society of South Africa, and those are our views that we express here. Licensing Executive Society provides leadership and training worldwide, and the essence of that training is aimed at gaining value in the knowledge economy and to assist people to exploit knowledge and innovation, which in the knowledge economy is valued above all else. And copyright is definitely one of those areas of law, of assets, that has gained a lot of value in recent years in the knowledge economy. And LSI aims to advance the business of intellectual property copyright through the creation, protection, and then very importantly, commercialization of innovation. Without the commercialization of innovation, the authors, the owners, and the assets themselves become stagnant and lose value, and that affects local economies as well as the international trade in these assets. So managing and monetization of IP and technology transfer is a big focus of Licensing Executive Society. In addition, Licensing Executive Society has conducted regular royalty rate and deal term surveys. It's probably the only international organization that's done this type of work, and has over many years tried to understand what is happening with royalty rates in different technology areas and also in different, and then also to get an idea of what the contractual relationships and the standard terms are that are part of deals that are done internationally. So, as I mentioned, technology transfer and licensing is the focus of our organization, and most licensing these days do not involve single types of IP. You normally have a large bundle of rights that are put together in a type of deal, and technology transfer is a big part of that. One can think for a startup from a university, if there's a new innovation, there are all sorts of IP bundling that takes place. A lot of the materials and the actual technology transfer would attract some form of copyright protection on it, That is part of the bundle that is life. And if there are concerns about certain IP types and the types of protection, burdens that are automatically placed on certain types of IP, that will affect the entire transaction. And that is one of our main concerns, is that this proposed legislation will have dire consequences for many technology transfer licenses and attempts. Technology transfer is an extremely important tool to drive economic growth and the global economy and also local economy. And if we start to make changes to legislation that negatively affect and put a restraint or a strain on technology transfer, many industries, many research organizations will be negatively affected by it. Some of the specific issues, so before we go there, so this background is important in our view because it explains from the position that we cover. I think the previous presentation for PASA has identified specific problems in the publishing sector and concerns that they have. Now, those types of concerns, they are different ones, but they are present throughout the different fields of technology and different fields of licensing. So we would like to present an overarching view on some of the issues that we have identified that, in our view, negatively affects economic growth, create economic risk for South Africa and for South African authors and copyright owners, and also puts the bill at risk for successful legal and constitutional challenge. And the first concern is a referral to one of the international dispute resolution fora, like, for example, World Trade Organization, where there is non-compliance with international treaties. So we take a broad view. There are other parties that deal with specific issues, specific technology fields, but we can also talk to those if required. But one of the issues that we've identified is the so-called reversion of rights clause. Now, the proposed limitation to the term of assignment or transfer of the literary and musical work are not true reversion rights. These are, in essence, 25-year limitations on the rights in those literary works and musical works. Specifically for literary works which we find problematic, those literary works include textbooks, articles, reports, memoranda, tables and compilations. Now, talking towards these tables and compilations, many industries, and they are, we can mention them, software, where source code compilations are important, insurance, financial advice, banking, data analysis fields, they all rely on copyright in these types of literary works to sustain their business. Those are part of their business models, their secret business secrets, and they use those to analyze, to conduct business, and to move forward. And a 25-year limitation on copyright in those works could have dire consequences for those very important business sectors in South Africa and globally. The first concern is that, as I mentioned previously, most commercialized works are multi-authored and multi-sourced. And single ownership of a copyright owner is essential in order to facilitate licensing, distribution, commercialization. And if the copyright component of that multi-source, multi-authored work intellectual property work is damaged, that will affect the entire value chain of that technology transfer. We are seriously concerned that the 25-year limit will be to the financial detriment of South African authors, copyright owners, and composers, and will in essence result in a de facto commercialization lifetime for many literary and composers' works of 25 years now. As you know, 50-year lifespan is there or at present, and that would significantly curtail the value that the South African authors could gain from their works. There's no similar term limit anywhere else in the world. And the economic and constitutional impact of this proposed limitation is unknown. There's been no assessment of the economic impact of it, and nothing has been published. I'm sure nothing has been put before the committee, and this is a serious concern. The reversion of rights as originally proposed by the Copyright Review Commission of 2011 can be supported, but that is limited to musical works and is based on the US model. And that US model has the various safeguards and provisions which apply, and it's a small carve-out, completely different from what we have here at the moment. And that's why we say this is a real concern about the scope and the impact of this provision. The contractual overrides that are being proposed will result in significant legal uncertainty. There can be, in terms of if those provisions are adopted, there can be no voluntary renouncements or waiver of any grants, rights granted under the Act. For example, moral rights, statutory royalty entitlement, copyright, sales, and the commercial value of works would be diminished greatly. And the ability of copyright authors and owners to extract value will be curtailed. In addition, if there's an infringement allegation, an infringement case, and the defendant relies on one of these exceptions, then it would be impossible to negotiate a settlement, which might be very profitable and valuable to both the copyright owner and the defendant, and one would have to proceed and finalize the litigation. So that creates a big problem and can result in unnecessary and lengthy litigations on these types of infringements. So in short, the freedom to trade, in our view, is arbitrarily restricted by these provisions. If there are provisions for contractual overrides, they should be very specific and very limited in scope, and they must be based on proper research impact assessments which identify the specific need where those are then applied. And this did not happen in this case. These overrides that we have, there are no impact assessments on them, and we don't know what will happen in practice. Compulsory contract terms, a further concern. So again, the freedom to contract, as confirmed by the Constitution, will be impacted by these provisions. Significant powers are granted to the minister to prescribe standardized and compulsory terms. And this is quite problematic. As the various research that the Licensing Executive Society International has done proves, there are no standard contracts or generalized set of contractual terms. The terms differ from case to case, differ from technical field, economic field, differ from jurisdiction to jurisdiction. The outgoing licensing, incoming licensing, They are all different. And to try to prescribe contractual terms, minimum contractual terms, in a general sense, in our view, is simply impossible. And if something like that happens, it will have disastrous consequences for a number of fields and for different technology transfer and licensing arrangements. In many industries, there are industry-specific solutions that's been found by parties and implemented very successfully. But prescribed contractual terms will override that. And in our view, it's a step backward. The conflicts with labor laws and employment contracts might arise. Incentive schemes that many employers provide for their employees might be null and void, and there's another concern. Lack of parliamentary oversight, which may lead to violations of constitutional rights to trade and in property. So we are concerned about these powers which are granted. We are of the view that government intervention into private contractual dealings should be limited to exceptions which are clearly identified, assessed for market faults. And if those market faults are identified in those limited specific areas, then specific provisions can be made for those. But no general compulsory contract terms as proposed. I think as other presenters over the last sessions have identified, an overly prescriptive business environment could deter new content production and commercialization projects. It is well known that producers of content spend significant funds not only on towards the authors, the copyright owners, but there are large economic benefits in other sectors that come from these content producers. But these content producers can literally go anywhere in the world. And if we create an environment through our copyright legislation that provides a barrier, it can be expected that these producers will go somewhere else. And that's to the detriment of the entire economy. Prescribed royalty rates, again, something that a lot of research has been done at Licensing Executive Society International. And that research has shown that royalty rates differ greatly between industry sectors, territories, and ultimately depends on the economic value of a specific bundle of rights. And that economic value is not necessarily the value that the copyright owner or author thinks has. It is the value in the market. And to have prescribed royalty rates might seriously curtail the ability of copyright owners, South African copyright owners, and South African authors to negotiate deals and to gain benefits from their works. We are not sure whether the intended prescribed royalty rates are intended to override negotiated rates and tariffs. And as we say in the last bullet point, I mentioned it, that prescribed royalty rates in our view would reduce South African authors and copyright owners' ability to negotiate the market-related and economically viable royalty rates. Because there's no point to ask a higher royalty rate and then fail to commercialize intellectual property. Then nobody gets. Moving on to some general comments on the bill, and in our view, significant flaw in the process so far. We have been unable to find any economic impact and constitutional and international treaty compliance assessment of these provisions. We know that copyright is intellectual property, and we know our courts have held that it's a form of property. So constitutional considerations do play a role in assessing these new provisions. The exceptions that underpin that are included in the copyright bill must be underpinned by policy number one, as well as a proper socio-economic and legal impact assessment. Some of these new exceptions have very far-reaching economic consequences, and we've heard this morning of some of those for PASA. And the copyright holders will be affected in ways that is completely unknown because of the wide scope of these exceptions in the current Act. Some of these exceptions do not exist anywhere else in the world. I think that point has also been made this morning, is that if people want to start playing experiments with the South African economy, as well as the rights and benefits of South African authors and copyright holders, then there needs to be proper economic assessments before we can prescribe to those experiments, because that's what they are, and that is a concern. Our copyright laws will have provisions in that are not compatible in other jurisdictions and will be frowned upon from other jurisdictions. Some of these were actually rejected in places like the UK and others where they were proposed at some point. So some of these exceptions are justly deprive copyright holders of rights which they currently hold. And again, that is a serious constitutional problem that needs to be properly assessed. Three studies that we know of preceded the bill. They were the Copyright Review Commission report of 2011. There is the Genesis of the reports from Professor Powers, his article on the economic contribution of copyright-based industries in South Africa. And then the Genesis report of 2014, which is the assessment of the regulatory proposals on the intellectual property policy framework. Now, not one of those was a socio-economic impact study on these provisions in the copyright. The Copyright Review Commission, made research proposals for legislative reform. No impact assessments were done on those, and they only recommended extensions of the exception to personal use. And fair use proposals and some other proposals on the exceptions were not dealt with that review commission in detail. Professor Porus's article was part of a larger population of studies, and it was a local study on the economics impact of copyright industries. It was not a WIPO study, and the author does not assess any of these exceptions that are in the bill. There is, in the end of the article, some gratuitous and personal opinions on exceptions, but these were not implemented. Some of them were based on discussions in the United Kingdom. They were not implemented in the United Kingdom, and there's no impact assessment of those. Genesis report, similar, was dated 2014. He did not look at these exceptions specifically, and actually stated that fair use are areas that are vague, poorly articulated, and poorly evidenced, which require further attention. That's on page 186 of the Genesis report, and it's important that one look at the correct Genesis reports. There were two, the first one that was withdrawn, a shorter one, and the complete one came a couple of days after the first one. So we say that these studies provide no basis for for believing that these exceptions to some of these proposals in the bill will be to the benefit of South Africa. They make no assessment of the constitutionality, and they also make no assessment of whether these proposals will comply with our international treaties. So in summary, for us, our concerns regarding the constitutional vulnerabilities of these proposals is the scope and the nature of the limitations to the term of assignments, as well as some of the new exceptions, the contractual override and compulsory contractual terms restrict freedom to contract and constitutional rights to trade and property, and the lack of social, economic and legal, both constitutional and treaty impact assessments for these provisions. Thank you very much.
Thank you. The South African Licensing Executive led by Danny and Mr. Dupree, that is the team that is presenting on behalf of licensing South Africa, Licensing Executive Society of South Africa. That is the team that was presented. Just need to check from the team and the platform. I've seen Honorable Bosho has a hand up. Over to you, Sonia.
Thank you very much, Chair, and good afternoon to everybody. Sorry for not switching on the video, but I am in load shedding as we speak. To the presenter of LESI, thank you very much. It's a good presentation that was tabled, and I'm pleased to see that this company regularly conducts a royalty rate and a deal term with its creators. Can the presenter please explain to me how they do it and what informs these royalty rates and deal term surveys? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Thank you, Honorable Bosho. Let me also throw my clarifying question to the team. Is the team from where they come from of the view that the current system of technological protection measures adequate enough to provide the legal protection that is needed, particularly with regard to the online environment. The current protection makes enough provision to take care of the aspect of exceptions that are included in the bill, my question is informed by areas that I believe from your presentation, because a key among them is the extrapolation of new rights versus exceptions, particularly with regard to one, there is a sense that you have the view that one size fits all doesn't apply in the industry. And the issues around a reversion right, because what I could sense also from the presentation is you talk about miscast reversion, miscast reversion of rights to certain authors and performers. But also the broadness and also the expansiveness of the exceptions. The sense that I get is that you are saying that they are sweeping, and as a result thereof, can erode potential revenues for the performers and copyright owners. Over to you, Denny.
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson, and Honourable Member Bosso. So, just on a point of clarification, the licensing executive society international, as well as the licensing executive society South Africa, are both non-profit organisations which represent industry stakeholders. So we're not a company as such, but a non-profit organization. And so on the rate survey, what Executive Society International does, they on a biannual basis, sometimes slightly longer, send out surveys to the members of the Licensing Executive Society. Now, as explained earlier, many of those members, and I would say most of them, are involved in technology transfer and licensing at some or other level, either as professionals in companies that deal with technology transfer and the licensing, both of technology outwards of companies or inwards, university tech transfer offices, people that are involved with new startups, commercializing innovation on behalf of universities and governments, and then also lawyers, which we specialize in the field. And many of these deals that these professionals are involved with are not confidential, and the request is essentially then for those professionals in those myriad of deals. And it would be from motion pictures, music. I felt to mention earlier, Joanna Freer next to me is a co-chair of the Copyright Committee of Licensing Executive Society International. So there's a large group of individuals that deal with that type of copyright transactions. There are obviously also others in all sorts of fields. Just from a South African perspective, they would be from biotech, mining, software, etc., etc. So it goes on and on. And so those deals are then reported by those members, and the information that they are allowed to provide regarding royalty rates for different types of technologies, different types of transactions, as well as doing some of the deal terms. So that is how those surveys are done, and how that information is then compiled, and there are publications that are available for purchase, and the Licensing Executive Society International then also uses that information to apply to WIPO and to make recommendations to WIPO. So that is how that information comes about, and it's global information on various technology fields. So when we talk about technology transfer, it the transfer of information in a licensing deal where a deal is made between the copyright and intellectual property owner and somebody else that wants to utilize it for a fee or some other arrangement. And yes, it applies to all sorts of technology. Honorable Chairperson, you are correct. There are online environments where these type of information is often licensed. And at the moment, yes, our Copyright Act and our contractual law allows for licensing of contents for online usage. I think there's a bigger problem, yes, and it's just personal view, is that some of the online content providers are not always satisfied with that position. And then views it from a different perspective than the author and the copyright owner in South Africa, which might feel there's abuse of their rights and that they are not being provided with fair compensation. But that is a specific problem. And the concern is that many of the generalized provisions that might have come from an idea of a specific problem is then used across the board, and that's one of the concerns with the extension of the term limitation to literary works. Literary works are far broader and different and used in a completely different context than, say, a musical work would be used. And it's simply impractical in many of the fields where literary works are used to use the same provisions. The reversions of rights, and the erosion of rights, I think on the reversion of rights issue is exactly that you are limiting the term of that you can commercialize these works to 25 years in effect. And most of us know that many artists, the real value in the works come later in life. It comes towards the end of the life of the intellectual property. And you are not taking away the first 25 years, you are taking away the last 25 years, which has got the most detrimental effect to a copyright owner or author. I don't know if those answer your questions.
Indeed they do, they do, they do. Jenny, I guess it's only correct in the absence of any hand to suggest that other members are comfortable with the presentation that that we have made on behalf of Licensing Executive Society of South Africa. And on that note, let me then take this opportunity to, on behalf of the committee, extend a word of gratitude to yourself and Johan de Vries for honoring our invite. Indeed, it was an enhancement in terms of the public hearing, but also an opportunity for us to also get a sense of where you come from and the work that you do, your area of expertise, has enriched our understanding of your views. And on that note, again, a word of gratitude to you. And we will proceed and then agree that as we continue to deliberate and continue to interact, in the back of our mind will be views that we have expressed, Danny and Johan, to three. Thank you.
Honorable Chairperson and members of the committee, thank you very much for your audience. We appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Great. Honorable members, let's then take the last presentation before we adjourn for lunch, which will be South African Guild of Actors, which will be led by Mr. Dave Naran, and Mr. Krugman. If they are on the floor, I can see their presentation. They can hit the floor running.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. and good afternoon to the honourable members of this committee. My name is Jack Devnarine. I'm an actor. It's a great privilege to make my oral submission on behalf of SAGA in accordance with my mandate as chairman. I am grateful to this for the stakeholder engagement as an exercise of the democratic process, and I appreciate that this is an opportunity to hear from all interested parties. I have studied and practiced my craft as a freelance performer for over 20 years, and my reality, like all freelance performers, is that if I don't work, I don't earn. I'm currently in production with a feature film, and the producer has kindly made me available for this session. My brief today is to offer you a context for the bills and to introduce you to SAGA's legal representative, Kelly Crockman, who will deal with the technical points of the bills under review. South Africa has one of the most worker-friendly labor regimes anywhere in the world, with the Labor Relations Act, Employment Equity Act, the National Minimum Wage Act, among others, all coming into effect post-1994. Their purpose was to reform the labor regime crafted under apartheid that placed all the rights on the side of the employer and that harvested the sweat of the workers in the form of profit, while denying workers themselves a rightful share of the fruit of their labor. These transformative laws post-1994 didn't just seek to end the wholesale abuse of worker rights, but effectively promoted the participation of workers at an organizational level and put a premium on the relationship between the worker and the employer. In many sectors, like freight, agricultural, mining, manufacturing industries, not only do workers have the protection of labor laws, but they also have the right to unionize and to engage in collective bargaining that allows them to negotiate their own working terms and earning rates. In this context, Honourable Chair, the creative sector stands out as an anomaly in the post-1994 landscape because creatives are denied both the statutory protection and the collective bargaining rights. The creative sector remains entirely unregulated, and it would be profoundly dishonest to claim that the sector is a self-regulating system that fairly balances the earning and working rights of performers. The reality is that performers are still subject to an imbalance of bargaining power and offered contractual terms they have no right to negotiate. Of course, those who profit from the structural imbalance in our creative sector take full advantage of the lack of regulation, proclaiming that the industry is a well-oiled machine of self-regulation, sunshine and roses. They will hold up a crucifix if you mention the word transformation. They will accuse you of chasing away foreign investment for daring to suggest regulation of the sector. But what they may forget to tell you is that the foreign investment they welcome all originate from regulated creative sectors. SAG-AFTRA, the American Actors Union, has a membership that is 160,000 strong. The Mauritian Performers Union already have collective bargaining rights. The Swedish Actors Union is 130 years old. Regulation of the sector is nothing new to the rest of the world. Someone is yet to explain why it can't be so in South Africa. Regulation provides investor confidence by defining the rights and responsibilities of employer and worker groups under a policy framework that offers uniformity and certainty. Regulation offers predictability and a vision of a shared future of the industry. Most importantly, it allows all parties to share an equitable stake as partners in a sector that can have a sustainable future. It is the direct result of a lack of industry regulation that the COVID relief funding efforts in the creative sector have been a catastrophic failure. While millions of rand were made available to help sustain artists through a complete shutdown of performance venues and production projects, the primary difficulties were in identifying who qualified for funding and who did not, and what structures to engage to disburse the funding in a transparent manner. Time after time, performers had to listen to ministerial briefings about the difficulties in bringing life-saving relief to performers during COVID. But even up to today, Honourable Chair, nobody can point points to any structural or policy changes that have remedied the deficiencies identified during lockdown. For many theatrical venues, it's too late. They shut their doors, they never reopened. Perhaps they can be revived if there's the political will. But we lost lives too, and that can never be undone. South African actors have never had a right to earn royalties, even though musicians and composers have enjoyed that right for nearly 60 years. The provision of actor royalties in the bills is a lifeline, so actors can earn a residual income from their work, which is continually exploited even long after they have passed on. It doesn't bear mentioning that had actor royalties been secured in statute decades ago, many performers who have passed on, who remain household names even today, may have had a fighting chance at keeping poverty at bay. We must never forget how such legends as the late Henry Kwele, Joe Mapela, Menzi Ngubane, Mary Twala, Elise Kaywood, and so many others never saw a single cent of the earnings that producers and broadcasters continue to earn even today, as their work is licensed and viewed around the world. Saga did not invent royalties for actors. It's a well-established industry norm practiced around the world. It is a mechanism by which Morgan Freeman from the US can earn royalties for his portrayal of Nelson Mandela. So you would be right to feel outraged that South African actors working alongside Mr. Freeman do not qualify for royalties. Having learned from the experience of musicians who report that their royalties have been stolen, it makes sense that the CAB and the PPAB have been linked. So the royalty right for actors can be supported by a mechanism by which those royalties can be calculated and dispersed by a collective management organization dedicated to the audiovisual sector. SAGA has participated in every parliamentary stakeholder engagement process since the bills were introduced to the National Assembly in 2017. And in 6 years, Chair, it is alarming how many stakeholders have lost track of why the bills were drafted in the first place. It is abundantly clear from some of the stakeholder submissions this committee has heard that many have failed to move on from 1967 when the Performers Protection Act came into being. For context, 1967 was also the year that the apartheid government enacted the dreaded Terrorism Act. And during that year, the 21st session of the United Nations declared apartheid to be a crime against humanity. At that time, TV had not been introduced to South Africa, and VHS, DVD, the internet, and streaming was the stuff of science fiction. Time and technology have moved on, but the laws that were intended to protect performer interests have remained anchored to an era that we should long have outgrown as a nation. Those apartheid-era laws remain in effect today, and this should concern every South African with a social and a moral conscience. Similarly, the Copyright Act of 1978 is out of step with technology and with the fair earning rights of performers in the modern era. Being denied a reliable structure for industry regulation means we have no option but to turn to statute for the minimum protection that can be afforded to performers. We turn to you. The very sustainability of the creative sector is in the balance, and it cannot wait for another 50 years while time and technology leaps ahead into the next era. The bills are our lifeline and our way forward. There have been grossly ill-informed assertions made to this committee by detractors of the bills. If we are to seriously embrace the project of transformation, we need to call out these obstacles to our progress. For example, we hear arguments to suggest that the bills conflict with obligations under international treaties to which South Africa aims to accede. On the contrary, the bills are firmly rooted in the Berne Convention and are aligned with the provisions of the WPPT, TRIPS, and the Marrakesh and Beijing treaties. My colleague, Kelly Kloppen, will address these aspects in more detail. Another contention that begs a rebuttal is that the bills permit background performers or extras to earn royalties. In fact, extras do not sign performer contracts, nor do they trade on their image or performance skill. The Beijing Treaty is clear that it does not provide a royalty earning right to extras, which is a fact many opponents to the bills seem to studiously ignore. Vested interests tend to raise protests against prescribed minimum provisions to be contained in contracts. It is argued that this infringes on the right to freedom of contract. Sagar contends that for freelance artists, freedom of contract is no more than an illusion, a mirage projected onto a backdrop of asymmetrical bargaining power and the one-sided negotiation experienced by actors. The naysayers further decry the authority delegated to the minister to draft regulations and amend them from time to time. We submit that in the fast-evolving digital realm, the flexibility of the legislation to adapt to new challenges must be welcomed and embraced. As the fourth industrial revolution sweeps the globe, to follow the cynical advice of the critics is to declare the project of statutory transformation to be dead and buried. And on that note, I hand the reins to Kelly Kropman, who will add substance to our submission.
Thank you, Jack, and thank you to this esteemed committee, who holds this power as bestowed on you by the Constitution. We thank you for taking up the responsibility of advancing the lives of South Africans. The constitutional issue that is at the forefront of today's discussion is that of the deprivation of property rights. Property rights of actors. Actors who have done us proud, both locally and internationally, and actors who have embodied our dreams and given shape to our hopes and fears and become part of our collective lived experience. During COVID, theatres were shut down and film productions came to a halt. And as Jack said, when an actor doesn't work, he doesn't earn. Residual income in the form of performance royalties would have come in useful at this time, but our actors are denied that right. No one may be arbitrarily deprived of their property, yet actors are being deprived of their rights to receive royalties because of a particular piece of law that is missing. That is what we're asking of you today. The constitutional right to property obviously does not stop at the physical things, and it's not contentious to say that intellectual property is property as well. And therefore, why should actors be denied the right to benefit from their own intellectual property? Obviously, I ask rhetorically, because this legislature has already indicated that it believes that the deprivation should stop. These bills were first introduced in May 2017, and we sincerely hope that we are at the end of the road and the objective of the legislature will be finally realized. Passing these bills will provide performers with some of the protections against exploitation. This is so because when negotiating with producers, they will be able to assert their rights in terms of Section 3A of the PPAB as to ensure that they are fairly remunerated of their rights to receive royalties for their performances. In previous meetings of the legislature around this year, questions have been raised about the lack of litigation in terms of the Performance Protection Act. The simple answer is that performers in the audiovisual and cinematic spaces cannot afford to litigate. There will be litigation against producers and broadcasters and studios who seek to exploit them. As the current Act fails to properly secure them, it's behind in technology and the common practices of the sector, litigation is far too much of a gamble for performers to take, especially with no statutory protections to cushion them. The other side of this, of course, is that blacklisting within the sector to anybody who makes waves is a pervasive practice. Blacklisting would be a violation in labor law. It should apply to actors, but it doesn't. This is because actors do not derive the benefit of labor law at all, as they're classed independent contractors. Independent contractors can only rely on the security derived from contracts. The law of contract, however, is shown to be no safeguard, but rather a form of exploitation because of the lack of bargaining power and the imbalance in negotiation power between actors and those who would engage them. When an actor raises issues with a contract on offer, there is no negotiation, but rather a more compliant actor will be caught. But due to the high levels of exploitation in the industry, they take whatever work they can get. This is a series of compromises that ends up at a race to the bottom. Section 23 of the Bill of Rights grants everybody the right to fair labor practices, and including the ability to collectively bargain in the work. But everyone does not include actors. Performers cannot collectively bargain or negotiate because they are considered independent parties. So they attempt to band together to stop abusive or exploitative practices, they'll fall foul of the Competition Act, as any discussion is deemed collusion, and any resolution is anti-competitive and unlawful. SAGA has, in the past, been subject to the scrutiny of the Competition Commission for this reason. South Africa is a signatory to the Berne Convention and has already made commitments in terms of protecting intellectual property from unfair exploitation. South Africa took another momentous step forward by signing the WIPO Performances and Phonographs Treaty in December 1997, although it has not yet completed the ratification process. The legislature has incorporated provisions of the Beijing Treaty into the draft legislation under review, and in doing so, the legislature has recognized the necessity for these protections and chooses to recognize the binding nature of this international law. The PPAB and CAB, when adopted into domestic law, will breathe life into the WPPG and Beijing Treaty. So South Africa is giving effect to its international law obligations in an elegant manner. For this, we applaud the legislature. And there is nothing that we can find in these amendment bills that is in direct contravention of either of these treaties. There's a fallacy that's been introduced to this House. It has been claimed that the audiovisual work includes the fixation of hundreds of performances, including those of background extras who would be eligible to claim royalties. This interpretation is provided in order to tear down a number of the provisions in the bill. The rationale is that the definition of performer is too vague and too broad. This is not true. The definition of performers in these bills is consistent with one contained in the Beijing Treaty, which is expressly interpreted to exclude background extras. Absurdity is not read into legislation, and to do so would be an insult to the drafters. I'm sure we can all appreciate that there is a difference between performing and appearing on screen. The ability to understand the simple distinction can be extended to producers and broadcasters as well. The entities raising the strawman argument are doing so to avoid paying actors anything more than they do now. If they could pay less, they would. In terms of the question of equitable remuneration, in arguing against the provisions of Section A of the CAB and Section 3A of the PPAB, it has been incorrectly claimed that there is an immutable right to royalty with no option of offering buyout in respect of the author's exclusive rights. This is another fallacy. What's more, it is claimed that the pool of royalties will be shared and diluted by the hundreds that will be in line to claim a slice of the pie. This is not true. While the CAB makes no mention of equitable remuneration, Section 8A is clear that the royalty provision is subject to the PPAB, or rather the Performance Protection Act. In the PPAB, in the Performance Protection Act, the preamble itself is explicit that royalties and equitable remuneration are interchangeable. For the sake of clarity, equitable remuneration is used in terms of WIPO treaties to refer to fair compensation that should be paid to rights owners for certain uses of their works. Actors generally have a bundle of exclusive rights that they can license to producers in exchange for equitable remuneration. These rights are individually quantifiable and negotiated accordingly, such as the right to record their performances, to reproduce their recorded performances, to distribute copies of their recorded performances, to rent their recorded performances, to make their recorded performances available to the public, such as through on-demand services, the right to broadcast their recorded performances, to communicate their performances to the public, to sell, rent, or otherwise transfer ownership of their performances. The phrase equitable remuneration appears no less than 14 times in the PPABN. A few examples illustrate how often it is used to describe the performer's unwaiverable right to authorize. Broadcast of their live or unfixed performances in terms of Section 3, Sub 4A. The communication to the public of their recorded or fixed performances in terms of Section 3, Sub 4G. The transfer of rights to the producer subject to a written agreement, which includes the necessary subsequent transfer along the value chain in terms of Section 3A, Sub 3B. By now, it should be clear that SAGA is in support of the bill, and we urge this House to recommend their adoption. However, SAGA would like to place on record its disappointment that an opportunity was squandered when the National Assembly elected to drop provisions of the CAB. Section 8A5 of the bill had intended to introduce an element of restorative justice into the legislation. The Portfolio Committee of the DTISD was rightly concerned about the previously untransformed creative industry and the unfair bargaining power that deprived performers of their royalty, and so opted for the inclusion of the so-called retrospectivity clause. Retrospective, or backward-looking, is not retroactive or backward-acting. In discussing the Beijing Treaty, WIPO refers to such clauses as proactive. In the past, actors were expected to assign their rights, often for a pittance, without receiving any royalties in return. The Portfolio Committee had sought to address the historical exploitation through this clause, which, should it deprive rights holders at all, would be considered a justifiable deprivation. It is important in law to ensure that where deprivation of property occurs, such deprivation is not arbitrarily done. Where deprivation leads to a benefit, a balance between that benefit and the potential harm must be considered in an open and democratic society. In this instance, it is the actors who live in poverty as a result of not being fairly compensated who would benefit. It is through this lens that the proactive application of legislation into older works should be understood. The provision in Section 8A5A2 envisions that when a new license is sought for a commercial exploitation of an old work, the actor would receive royalties which is generated through the sale of the new license. Say, for example, if Sarafina is licensed for broadcast the day after the enforcement and enactment of the bills, this would mean that when a broadcaster pays the rights holder for the new license, the royalties would be able to be paid over to the actors from today. This does not mean digging into the pockets of the past and making claims against producers for profits generated before the commencement date. Just provides that future profits will be shared equitably. If the film is never relicensed, then there will never be more money made from it and nothing would be shared. Lamentably, the Portfolio Committee was persuaded that the provisions constituted a retroactive and arbitrary deprivation of property. This clause has been dropped and does not appear in the version before you. If SAGA had its way, the provisions would be reinstated. Thank you. I thank you all for your time. I'm going to hand back to Jeff.
Thank you, Kelly. The arts and entertainment industry has almost completed its race to the bottom. The minimum hours of work in a day has gone from 10 to 12 hours. The pay is reducing. Compliance with on-set safety regulations is slipping. Actors are routinely called upon to provide additional services such as free marketing, free advertising and social media promotion, free product endorsement, free script translation. All the while being told we must be grateful for the privilege of being allowed to work, then living and dying hungry. These changes to actors' working conditions are not the result of a negotiation. There was no process. There was no consultation or consensus. It's the result of a unilateral exercise of unfair bargaining power. It's called bullying. We are on a slippery slope, and it's happening before our very eyes. Industry regulation is the key to growth and sustainability. Royalties and equitable remuneration are part of this. They benefit the film industry by motivating and incentivizing actors, attracting more investment and talent, and improving industry standards. South Africa has an opportunity to take its place amongst the world's finest content-producing industries. The bills, by their very nature, are forward-looking and progressive. They are transformative and empowering. They put the industry on a firm yet adaptable foundation to embrace the opportunities of the future and the technologies of the fourth industrial revolution. We ask this committee to participate in the transformation of the creative sector. We ask you to help restore the dignity of performers who tell the stories of our proud nation and whose work is celebrated around the world. We ask you to support the bills. Thank you all and good afternoon. The members of the Honourable Committee and to the Honourable Chair, thank you so much for your attention.
Thank you, Jack, and your team for the presentation, indeed very detailed, and impassioned through which the presentation was made. Really expresses the seriousness of which the team took our invite to have the views heard. We appreciate that, Chair.
Thank you.
Let me just check with the members. I know this is lunchtime, but I suspect in the absence of any hand, presentation was quite clear. That's one from my side. The somewhere where a point was made around the background extras are not eligible for performance royalty. Are they not part and parcel of the actors in the supply chain? Why are they excluded from royalties, if I may ask? I can just imagine those background actors who, after 25 years, they see themselves, every time they see themselves, then what comes to their mind is that, look, the producers are still benefiting, but I'm not getting anything.
Indeed. Yeah, thank you for the question, Honourable Chair. The reality in the industry is that there is a distinction, a material difference between the work of the performer and the work of the background extra. The distinction lies in the fact that I'm required as an actor to prepare my dialogue and to rehearse my performance, taking direction from the director, and to adapt my performance depending on how the story unfolds and how the story needs to be told. So that requires constant training. And in fact, this is something that even performers around the world, no matter how experienced they are, will continue to train at their craft. This is very different from what is required of a background extra. You will appreciate, Honourable Chair, that the background extra does not have lines of dialogue to learn. What they are required to do is to form a space within a certain photographic frame, almost as if, you know, in composing that frame, you needed to have, whether it's, you know, some kind of a backdrop, whether it's a curtain and furniture, or whether there are people who are moving about in the background of an office space. That is what is required. And they do not, in that sense, add to the value of the film because they are not telling the story, as it were, in the way that a performer does.
How do you draw a distinction between a producer that engages in a production of a series through the guidance, through the contract between himself and a broadcaster and a producer. Because definitely the broadcaster will contract with the producer to produce a series. And only in that situation, the producer will then obviously have to engage in a number of actors and a number of performers. Is that not a bit of inconsistency? Because I know that producers and broadcasters are also, in terms of the bargaining power, more stronger than an ordinary actor and a performer in the series. Yes.
Yes. Thank you, Chair. And I'm glad you raised this point, because where we find the inconsistencies in the relationship between, and we can call it a tripartite relationship with the actor, the broadcaster, and the producer, this is where the bills seek to introduce consistency. Because as we currently sit, if I have to sign onto a soapy and being on a soapy on Isidingo on SABC3 for 15 years, I can tell you with great experience behind me that the contract that I signed came from the broadcaster. If I'm on an ETV soapy, again, that contract comes from the broadcaster. So the producer in that value chain is there to facilitate the relationship and the balance of the rights and obligations. So they do not draft the contract, as it were. They are basically offering me the contract that comes from the broadcaster. So what we need to do as performers is that we have never been able to negotiate the terms of that contract with the broadcaster, because there is no mechanism for that negotiation process. Because we don't have the collective bargaining rights, it means we cannot sit opposite the broadcaster to provide input in the drafting of that performer's contract. What I am given is what I get, nothing more and nothing less. When it comes to, and I know you pointed out the distinction, there are film producers, and perhaps they have raised the money on their own. They are not being commissioned by a broadcaster. They are now embarking on a project where they are producing an independent film. And that would be a different scenario. In that case, that producer is drafting that contract on their terms. And again, Chair, there is no mechanism for me as an actor to provide input into that contract. And what we are asking for is that if our lawmakers cannot be relied upon to provide us a structure for collective bargaining, if we cannot rely on that kind of regulation, then all we have left to help us balance those scales is statute. So we come to the lawmakers to say, you've got to give us something. Otherwise, we are caught between an unfair contract, no collective bargaining rights, and threats by the Competition Commission to block us from engaging in a meaningful dialogue with the other people in that value chain. And SAGA has already been reported to the Competition Commission for trying to do just that.
Thanks, Jack and Krugman, for that comprehensive presentation, and also making use of the platform that you have created to empower us more in terms of engagement, first and foremost, once you have reached the point of taking a decision, at least at the back of our mind will be echo of the transformative justice, equitable remuneration. I think those are the key messages that you mentioned from the presentation. Thank you a lot, Chief.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. Thank you to members of the committee.
Great. Honourable members, I think our agenda for lunch. Let's come back around
Recording 20, stopped.
20 plus 2, if honorable members agree on that. Do I have a support on this, Sonia? Right. Maria?
Okay.
Yeah, we will resume at 20 past 2. Is that okay?
Understood, Chief.
Thank you. Thanks a lot. The meeting is adjourned.